support for their work. And except for a bump about 6 years ago, they usually go home virtually empty-handed. So this year, the CEOs of Lutheran Social Service, Catholic Charities of the Twin Cities, and the Wilder Foundation have made the Homeless Youth Act our top priority. The governor has put $5 million in his supplemental budget for the Homeless Youth Act, and we appreciate that. And now we need the support of the legislature, and they need $8 million. These young people know that you have tough jobs and that you're balancing lots of really big issues. They're simply asking for an opportunity to become productive adults in our communities. So please don't let them go home empty-handed this year. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Harpstead. Do we have other testifiers? Please state your name for the record.
Hi, Mr. Chair. My name is Corey Blevins. I was a youth who was formerly homeless for just under a year, and now I'm the Communications and Fund Development Intern at YouthLink, which is a program funded by the Homeless Youth Act. During my time being in my homeless state, I was surrounded by and introduced to a lot of things that I never thought I would be. You constantly get reminded through people and obstacles of your reality, and the reality is a lot of people, mainly a lot of people against you progressing, want you to use different things in order to find your way out. I ended up meeting and finding a lot of people, a lot of females who ended up sexually exploiting themselves because they figured that that was the only way to get what they needed. I ended up being surrounded by drugs that I feel a young person wouldn't even and shouldn't even consider, but being in that state, that's what they end up resulting to. I remember one time when I was downtown and I ran into a friend who ended up raging out in tears just because she was so frustrated and disgusted. She was frustrated because she felt as if that she was getting nowhere with her situation and disgusted that she ended up using her body to get what she needed by any means. I felt helpless and a little sad for her just because I was in the same condition, so I couldn't really do much. But I ended up being very hopeful, knowing that if we linked up with the right people at YouthLink, that won't be our life just ending up in that situation. And I know that if there was a lot more awareness and programs like YouthLink, there would be a lot more females who won't find their way out of this system by letting people into their bodies. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blevins, for your testimony. And I believe we have another testifier. Please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Thomas Fisher, and hello, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I'm from Minneapolis, and I'm 18 years old, and this is how I became homeless, and about who helped me out, and now how my life is. I was in an abusive relationship with my mom, not physically, but mentally. It was getting to the point where she was threatening to beat me up and having my stepdad or uncle come do it. I couldn't handle it anymore, so I asked my mom, "Do you even want me to be here anymore? Because it sure doesn't feel like it." I didn't want to live there anymore. To be honest, I was tired of being scared 24/7. My mom then said to get out of the house and not come back. I didn't really know what to do. So that night, I went to my school and I asked them all what to do. They mentioned shelters, but at that point in time, I was afraid to go to an adult shelter because I heard stories and that they make you sleep on the floor. So the first night I was homeless, I slept in my car at my school. That night it was very cold. I had clothes and food and a blanket, but it was very hard to sleep and extremely uncomfortable. The following day, one of my school counselors came in and suggested avenues for homeless youth, a shelter for youth. My school said that they had nice beds, nice staff, good food, and good kids in it. I made the call to Avenues, and that night I had a bed to sleep in and hot food to eat and people who care for me and watch out for me. I had talked to the other youth, and they had said that they had to call multiple times to get in, and then with my luck, I only had to call once. I spent 2 months in Avenues, and they helped me out so much. I met new people, and I made new friends that were in the same situation as me. I have talked to my mom, but all she wants to do is keep fighting with me, so I'm not talking with her right now because I feel like the situation has gotten worse. After 2 months of living, Avenues helped me get into the housing program. My Avenues roommate and I have moved into a two-bedroom apartment together. I can say that I feel much better that Avenues was there for me and how they still visit me to check on me. I feel that I have a very positive future ahead of me because of the support that I am getting, not only from Avenues, but also from the housing program. I'm working on finishing high school and thinking about a future as an auto mechanic or in criminal justice. Thank you for letting me share my story. And I have been to the Capitol before and have heard other youth testify about how homeless youth services like the Bridge, Safe House, Safe Zone, Youth Link, and my housing advocate from my school have helped others like me. Please fund the Homeless Youth Act so more young people like me can get support when they need it the most. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher, for your testimony. Very compelling. And thank you, Ms. Blevins, again. Senator Dibble, do you have any other testifiers at this moment?
Madam Chair, I do not. I'm able to respond to questions. I know that Senator Rosen has an amendment that she'd like to offer.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to offer the A2 amendment.
Be distributing that amendment and in that time, Ms. Senator Rosen, if you'd like to describe your amendment.
This is amendment that came out of the discussion, and I think actually Senator Benson mentioned this and was agreed upon by Senator Dibble. This is his language. I drew up my own. This is kind of a combination of everybody to agree on outcomes, accountability measures going forward to make sure that the dollars are spent effectively throughout the state. Geographically, and that there are accountability measures in place to make sure that we are getting to the youth in appropriate manner. So I would move the A2 amendment.
Senator Rosen moves the A2 amendment. Senator Dibble, would you like to respond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen is correct. This is a result of a conversation we had at the last hearing in the Policy Committee, particularly with Senator Rosen and Senator Benson, kind of drafted up our ideas, and Ms. White merged them very skillfully. I did want to ask Senator Rosen, did you want to make the report a biennial report?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Senator Rosen. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to make a oral amendment to line 3, scratching annual and making it biennial.
That's, Madam Chair, just to accommodate the wishes of the agency,
right,
to maybe not report, go to the expense of reporting. But it is, I think, important if we're successful in this request, it is a substantial increase in the amount of grant making that we do to support these efforts, and it's important for us to know how we do it, in what manner, what fashion, on a geographic distribution, because an important principle to keep in mind is that we often think of homeless youth in the metro, and that's absolutely false. The need is statewide and suburban. And really understanding the outcomes. Senator Benson in particular really pointed that out, that we're not simply measuring heads, but we're measuring what results as a,
no, he can amend it,
as a consequence of
she
these efforts.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Any members have any questions for Senator Dibble or Senator Rosen on the A2 amendment as orally amended? Hearing none. Senator Rosen again moves the A2 amendment as orally amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed signify by saying no. The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Musical backdrop to her amendments. Right. I'm available to respond to questions, ma'am.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dibble for accepting the Rosen Amendment. We're in the Finance Committee now, so we have to start asking about numbers. $8 million It's a big chunk of money. How much do we already spend on either youth homelessness or homelessness in total? Do you have that information, or is there somebody who can help with that?
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That I don't know the answer to that question specifically. You know, a lot of the homelessness, housing and homelessness dollars come through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And that's more for, you know, some of the actual facilities and bricks and mortar and the like. A lot of the services for supportive housing and transitional housing, emergency shelter, drop-in, street outreach, and that come through Health and Human Services. This particular effort has received a little bit of money here and there since we passed this bill in 2007, I think, you know, less than $1 million. But, yeah, Ms. Harfstead can help.
The Homeless Youth Services and Lutheran Social Service are the most patched together forms of funding every year in all of the things that we do. Most of the service funding that comes to all of our organizations comes from the federal government. We get some from counties. This particular area happens to be our donors' very favorite subject, and we get foundation money and some of those kinds of things. The state of Minnesota, through the Homeless Youth Act, has been funding $238,000 per biennium for the last several years.
And
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, it's important to distinguish that these services are for unaccompanied, unattached youth. The goal, of course, is to get them back with their families if that's possible. This isn't focused on young people who are with their families. This is a separate effort because that's a unique population that does need to be served.
And Senator Benson?
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, in looking at outcomes and youth being successful, I think it's worthy of some level of investment. I'm just trying to figure out where it fits in the pool of overall support for homeless Minnesotans. What's already existing, the $238,000 is a good number. It gives me kind of a marker as to what kind of impact $8 million would have. It seems like a big leap to go from less than $250,000 per biennium to, is it $8 million per biennium? Mm-hmm. And so, well, good ideas. It might be a little bit bigger leap than we can take this year. But
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. And if you know, Ms. Harpsett can help us figure out how we landed on the $8 billion figure. I will say that we got like $1 million once, and then the $238,000 is what we're able to do with those dollars has proven to be highly, highly effective. And that's why I'm happy that you asked for the outcome measures, because I think those will show that these dollars deployed. And if you read through the content of the bill and the comprehensive nature of the services that need to be funded, only those community-based agencies that are providing these services in this coherent and comprehensive and connected fashion are going to be eligible for the grants. The outcomes are amazing. I mean, I know that from my own experience. I've been on the board of a couple of different homeless youth serving organizations. I've seen the stories, the outcomes. And I would argue that these dollars deployed, in this amount, with this level of effectiveness, actually almost uniformly move young people into a successful adulthood. It's a highly, highly proven and effective way of spending these dollars. And it is a big leap, but I think I would be so bold as to say, for the most part, youth are going to fall into homelessness for all kinds of different reasons. That's going to continue to occur, for all kinds of different reasons. But if they're able to then come in contact with these community-based agencies across the state, it is a very effective way of moving them either back into community and family or onto successful adulthood.
Senator Benson?
And Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, just last fiscal question. Does the any part of the increased spending leverage more federal drawdown? I mean, you mentioned that a lot of the money comes from the federal government, so I'm trying to figure out what net impact this has.
Yeah.
Ms. Harpstead?
The federal government has been generous in the state of Minnesota in giving many of our organizations startup money to get going on building out homeless youth services. LSS was fortunate last year to get 4 grants to fund homeless youth service startups in Willmar, Mankato, Rochester, and Brainerd. And so we're working to try to build a net for youth throughout the state. That's all been funded by the federal government. And so $8 million feels like a leap from $238,000, but in our view, it's what the state of Minnesota should be at least doing to support its own homeless youth. To answer your very specific question, there's no federal drawdown or match for these dollars. We just think it's time for the state to step up to its share of supporting youth through these services. I will also just mention that as you look at housing and you hear about housing bills, most of the housing money in Minnesota ends up going for homeless families, homeless adults, or homeless young children, and very little of it ends up supporting youth. And so our youth end up falling through cracks in all kinds of areas of the state budget, which is why we're specifically calling out the Homeless Youth Act for services for youth from 12 to 24. And we also have interest in some of the bonding bill dollars this year for housing for homeless youth. But unless we specifically call out homeless youth, they tend to be the last in line for services and housing dollars.
Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, I'm wondering if you can give an idea of where this is going to end up in the budget. I do think this is an important bill, but yet the budget projections we're seeing from your leadership, we're looking at an increase of $3 billion in spending, but yet talk of $150 million reduction to Health and Human Services, which is what this would fall under. So do you have an idea of where this is going to end up, if it's going to be in a final bill? I mean, it is an important issue.
Right.
Senator Dibble?
Senator Brown, I'm counting on you as a member of this committee. I don't know specifically. I mean, my general sense is that there's a lot of strong and bipartisan support. There's support from the chair. You know, I'm aware of the 150,000 reduction target for Health and Human Services. I'm not happy about that, and so I'm hoping to actually change that. You know, I have no way of knowing. I'm sorry, I can't answer your question. I sit next to Senator Laurie on the floor, so I bug him quite a bit about it. I got kind of a big focus on transportation, trying to put those pieces together. I just don't know how the HHS budget is coming together. But knocking on wood, keeping my fingers crossed, prevailing upon the wisdom of this committee.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I do think we are hearing some of the concerns we have on this committee about targets as it relates to the size of the dollar amount. We're going to work on trying to make every dollar stretch and find ways to be able to support these important programs. It's what happens when there's a struggle. And everybody in this room as well as in the state of Minnesota knows of the enormous failure to support these programs for the last 11 years and the enormous deficit there is not only in our budgets but in the resources that we've funded and supported, including those for homeless youth. So I think the issue is for us as an entire legislature to confront ourselves about the history of how we've dealt with our budgets rather than take shots at the struggle that we're having right now in the budgetary process. And I know you don't need to respond to that, but what I would like from you, Senator, is to ask you, as you are working on this bill and as this moves forward, that this ability to articulate what this does for us when we make these important investments in youth, because part of what you'll be talking about is what we don't spend or what problems we don't create. Or what, and if people need that in order to spend $8 million to do the right thing, then we should have that. But I'm especially interested in that, Senator Dibble, not only for this, but for many places where we do important initiatives like this in Health and Human Services that saves this state money, that saves counties money, that saves corrections money, that saves hospitals money. And those cost savings are not attributed back to us to be able to support these programs, but go to the general fund for other programs. So this evaluation, this request that Senator Benson is talking about, is important to me for the purposes of our articulating as a committee the importance of the Health and Human Services and these groups receiving the rewards of the efforts to save money rather than continuing to get cuts in the Health and Human Services budget. So I'm hoping that that amendment that you've just agreed to accept results in data that helps us demonstrate why the state should now pay back Health and Human Services for a lot of the cost savings that we've engaged in other parts of the budget.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon, I couldn't express it better myself. If only we had dynamic scoring and were able to, you know, attribute fiscal, you know, savings in our fiscal notes. I know that's not a good path to go down necessarily, but it's absolutely true, and I think the coalition has done a wonderful job of bringing the stories forward of young people themselves, and they articulate their own stories in their own words. And I can just tell you, having been on the board of a couple of different serving agencies, the stories are extremely compelling. The success stories are astounding, and these dollars are very well spent and result in all sorts of foregone expense to the state.
Just to
Rosen?
Add a couple. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Just going to add to that.
Oh, okay.
Ms. Harpstead.
I'm sorry. We recently gathered all of the people who had ever been through our Renaissance Transitional Living Service in Duluth because the same person's been running it ever since it was formed and discovered that 90% of them are in stable housing 4 years after they've been with us. So we're delighted to hear about your amendment to report outcomes. We report outcomes all over the place every year, so we'd be delighted to share that. I would also say that of all the human services we're familiar with at Lutheran Social Service, homeless youth services are the least expensive and the most highest return of all the services that we do. Basically, these whole array of services that we're talking about in the Homeless Youth Act prevent very expensive adult homelessness, and they produce taxpayers, which then allows it to pay for itself in many ways. I appreciate you're asking a structural question about the budget process, but there's no doubt that these programs pay off in a big way.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to piggyback that, I think this is a really important discussion that we are starting off, especially with the first bill, Senator Dibble. So this is extremely important. And as you know, I'm a co-author on this bill, and I have supported homeless youth forever, ever since, actually, a trip I took to one of the shelters in your district. And I would encourage everybody to take a trip to either a homeless youth shelter or just a homeless shelter in their district or unfortunately, I don't have any except in Mankato, but that is an amazing transformation for someone to experience and hear their stories and see what they've gone through, but the potential that they have going forward. So perhaps this summer we can organize something, which would be great, to just go visit some of these sites. The importance of the A2 amendment that we just passed is, again, the ongoing support, but the responsibility that this $8 million comes with, and that we have to prove that this money is accountable and that we would love to continue that support as long as we show those accountability measures going forward. We're going to hear Senate File 797, Senator Claussen's next. And so my interest also is making sure that these homeless dollars are being utilized succinctly, and they're not just pockets and silos that we tend to do in state government. And so this ongoing discussion with these dollars, I think, is very important to make sure that we are just not creating, again, little silos that aren't coordinating with other people and other programs. Because we want this, we want to see the outcomes, and we want to make this successful. So that would be my goal with that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 565, as amended, be recommended to pass. Is there's no
laid on the table for possible inclusion.
Oh, excuse me.
Yep.
Laid on the table for possible inclusion.
When there are a couple of other people who would like to talk, and I would like to, you know, remind members. I wasn't here to get started. I had a bill up in taxes. Apologies for the tardiness, but let me just try to say what we need to go through here in order to get you know, an omnibus bill done by the 16th. We have, I think, 8 days of committee hearings, and we're going to be meeting some really late nights. Tonight is going to be one of them. We have tried to we decided to go with a couple of late nights rather than every single night, moderate night. I hope that works for members. But we have a great deal of work to get through here and incredibly meaningful topics to discuss that make a difference in people's lives and how they achieve success or don't. And so we need to be cognizant of the time as we move forward, but really foster a good conversation. And I'm told that this has been a really good one. With that, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll keep it short and just hope this applies for the next 3 days. But to the directors of the programs and the participants in programs like this, all it takes is one bad news story about somebody taking advantage of a program like this to make it really hard for us to keep funding good programs. And so I know you do your best to be efficient with your money, but internally, the young people who are here who can mentor other participants and the directors, if you can keep good discipline so we never have to see you in the news except for your successes, it makes it so much easier for us to support good ideas. One bad EBT story and I get 20 emails about how we're spending too much money. And so as we go forward and try to make the right investments and look for good returns, you know, just please do your best to be cognizant of these dollars and use them well. And that's thank you.
Senator Claussen.
You know, I'm going to be up next.
Okay.
And I almost feel like I should be sitting up there because there's so much. Senator Rosen's comments are very good about not creating silos and looking at the bigger, broader picture and how we're going to fund these initiatives. And
yes.
So I'll reserve my comments until
you're
our next bill.
With Senate File 797 next. Yes. And honestly, you know, I hope everyone has had a chance to visit some of the homeless shelters around the state. It's incredibly powerful. The one that sticks with me is when I showed up at St. Stephen's in downtown Minneapolis and watched the kids getting ready for school. Go in the morning. It's pretty powerful, and they're doing their homework and getting ready and need a hand.
Mr. Chair, it'll take you to your knees. Just about.
Yeah, it will. Mm-hmm. It will. It'll stick with you. Mm-hmm.
Or, Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
Another recommendation I have is to Youth Link, for example, has a graduation ceremony every year. Young people who have been a part of their program. Who have gotten back on their feet, stabilized their lives, and managed to finish high school or their GED, and then they get up and tell their personal stories. You won't come out the same.
Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 565 be recommended to pass and laid on that as amended, laid on the table for possible inclusion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Claussen, welcome to the committee.
No, let's do this. I'll do it. I mean,
Senate File 797. Welcome to the committee, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing our bill. I should start out with a little bit of letting you know my area of interest in the homeless and also some of my background. I currently serve as vice chair of a homeless shelter in Eagan for families. So if that's a shelter that the committee would like to visit in the future, I can certainly make that arrangement. Dakota Woodlands, and it's located in Eagan. I'm also, I've served on the Dakota County Affordable Housing Coalition, where we work on homeless, trying to prevent homeless, and also providing services for homeless. And then thirdly, in my other role in the past as a school administrator, I was the administrator for the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act. And the McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act was passed during the Ronald Reagan administration, and it requires school districts to do basically three things to assist homeless families and homeless students. First off, that we need to keep the student grounded in the schools. And so we provide transportation. So if we have a student in the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan Public Schools, where I served, and that student is in a shelter in downtown Minneapolis, like Mary's Place or People Serving People, we would transport those students back to our school district so they stay grounded in their educational setting. Secondly, those students are eligible automatically for meal service, breakfast and lunch at the school. And lastly, we would help those students with school supplies, additional tutoring, some academic needs that they may have. So that's a little bit of my background. And now to get into Senate File 797. The intent of Senate File 797 is to provide funding for a continuum of housing and related services for Minnesotans who face barriers to stable housing. And as we all know, the homeless numbers in Minnesota have been increasing. Homeless shelters throughout the state are at capacity, and supportive housing programs are not able to keep up with the need for services. I think many of you may be aware of every 3 years the Wilder Foundation conducts a one-day study to better understand the prevalence, causes, circumstances, and effects of homelessness. And I participated in that survey the last 4 or 5 years. The most recently conducted survey was in October of this past year, 2012, and we identified students in our school district who were homeless at that point, and those numbers have been increasing. The past year, we identified over 200 students in our school district, which is a suburban school district, fourth largest in the state, who were homeless and needed assistance. But during that October 2012 count, there were over 10,200 homeless adults, youth, and children that were identified. And between 2009 and 2012, we saw a 6% increase in the homeless numbers. And between 2006 and 2009, the state experienced a 25% jump in the homeless numbers. Usually that can be attributed to the downturn in the economy. And children and young adults represented about 46% of those total homeless population. I gave you some of the information for our school district. Over 200 homeless students were assisted last year. And there's really a variety of reasons that young people become homeless and their families. Bankruptcy, foreclosures, loss of employment, aging out of foster care, divorce, pregnancy, death of a parent, and also young people that are being asked to leave their homes are all situations leading to homelessness. I'd like to share one example of a part of the problem that in the population that I worked with students. One of the most difficult areas is finding a shelter for these students, unaccompanied youth. There are very few shelters that take unaccompanied youth, and it's very difficult to get services for them. I'll give you one example that's a little bit disturbing to me, and that is that we had a young man who was 18 years old. And please remember, there are some students that we will educate till age 21. So there are students that we will be assisting that are homeless through age 21. And this student became homeless during the school year. After couch hopping for about a month and a half, he finally was placed in Cochran House. Cochran House is a men's facility for the homeless in Hastings. It also is the number one shelter for inmates released from Stillwater Prison if they are homeless. So now we have an 18-year-old high school student that is in that type of a situation. And I think we heard testimony from the young man that speaks to maybe some of the issues that a young person might be faced in that type of a living situation. We've also worked with students that are at the Dorothy Day Center in downtown St. Paul. And couch hopping for many of these students is just a way of life. These are very vulnerable young people, still in high school, homeless, and obviously need assistance. But the bill that we're looking at, Senate File 797, is not only just for youth. It encompasses a wide range of the homeless. And if you look at the bill, line 1 point, actually subsection D, the $4 million is actually part of the Homeless Youth Act that was mentioned. And the issue about not having these appropriations in silos is extremely important, and I think that's something we're going to have to work out as a committee. So at this time, I am going to turn it over to some of the representatives from Home for All for testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Liz Coppola, and I work as executive director of the statewide Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Our 150 members stretch limited resources every day to serve the growing numbers of children, youth, and adults who fall through the cracks and into homelessness. I'd like you to first meet one of these children through a video, and so we'll see if we can make this work, and then I'll have some more remarks. The video is much better than this initial music that I'll start.
I'm told we already got a preview of the music while I was here.
Indeed.
My favorite person as a cartoon character is Hello Kitty. The reason why she's my favorite is because most cartoon characters don't make up funny jokes and they don't like be smart. And Hello Kitty, she is funny. If you've never been in a shelter, shelters are big with a lot of floors. It goes up to a certain number of PSPs, goes up to 10. And there's one room that you have to stay in with beds. That's what's different about a house and a shelter. This is where I sleep and I share my bed with my mom. I do my homework here. And in school, I like to do math. Because there's a lot of things that you have to solve, and you can solve them yourself without anyone helping you. My mom painted my whole wall pink, and I hanged it up posters, and she got me a big TV to go in it, and I got a desk with a pink lamp, and she put all the hairspray for me on my desk and the brush. And I said, Mom, why are you taking my stuff? And she said, because we're about to move into a shelter bed and we can't bring that stuff because we only have one room and it won't fit. Let's put it in storage. This is a place where people eat. And here in the cafeteria, it's busy. And I don't like when they put the vegetables. I don't like vegetables. I like fruit, so I usually keep on. You should be scared to go in a shelter, whoever it is, because they already have a lot of security guards that, like, guards lunchrooms to make sure anyone goes down there. But you can be sure. They lock the front door, and mostly all the shelters have to prove that. Mostly people have play dates, and they bring friends over, and they play, and they bring their cousins over, and they play, or they bring their family. You can't do that in a shelter. They'll say they can't. You can't bring pets in shelter. My cat got sent to the pet shelter because we were about to move in and couldn't come with. with us, but I had it since it was a baby this small. It will have four rooms, bathroom, dining room, and a living room, and a kitchen. I'm going to get kitty posters and Hello Kitty posters. And I have more space. If someone being mad to you, you can't go in the bathroom in the shelter because mostly people have to use the bathroom. In a home, when someone messes with you, you can't go somewhere by yourself. You can go in the basement or you can go in your room. Homeless is when you're on the sidewalk asking people for money and you don't have a home. But if you're staying somewhere, then you're not home. When you move into a shelter, that's just giving you time to look at a home that you want, so you're not homeless.
So we thank Minnesota Public Radio for recording Paris's thoughts and all of you for listening to her story. She is one of the lucky ones who gets a place in shelter. Mr. Chair and members, I know that most of us are still stunned with the news of this committee's targets and the hard work ahead of you to balance the state's budget. I'd like to take a few minutes to explain why, even with this enormous burden and the difficult decisions ahead, it makes sense to invest in homeless services. Here's what we know. We're spending money anyway on these same people. Without housing, these children and youth cost more money both now and long into the future. The Minnesota Department of Education reports spending over $8 million last year alone transporting homeless school children from the nearest shelter to the school they were attending at the time they became homeless. We do this because it's required by federal law. The idea is that since homelessness is so disruptive and often temporary, homeless children benefit from some level of continuity in their education. This $8 million per year is only half of what we seek in the Homeless Youth Act to provide the housing and supports our teens and young adults need to grow into productive adulthood. Wilder Research Center released new data just last year on the return of investment for families in supportive housing. They found that for every dollar invested, the state saves $1.44. Somebody said, this is like putting a dime in a gumball machine and getting your gum and your money back. This return on investment looks at the adults in families, looks at higher wages, lower incarceration, lower chemical dependency. This conservative estimate, this returning $1.44 for every dollar we invest, doesn't include potential savings from improved health, reduced emergency room use, or inpatient hospitalizations, or any child-related outcomes. Certainly, we know that child-related outcomes are important, and we know that children and youth make up half the homeless population in Minnesota. The Department of Education reported last year that 79% of Minnesota third graders are proficient in math, 79%. This number for homeless third graders, 33%. By eighth grade, the number drops to 16% for homeless students, while for all students, it's roughly 70%. Homeless children are three times more likely to have emotional and behavioral problems, four times more likely to have delayed development, and nine times more likely than housed children to repeat a grade. Further, we know adverse child experiences affect lives long into adulthood. We know what works in serving the over 10,000 Minnesotans who are homeless each night. Over the past 18 months, housing and homeless advocates have come together around targeted investments in housing and services. This bill today is the services side of our ask. It recognizes that we need targeted investment in a continuum of proven programs to stabilize families and prevent homelessness. We are joined in this comprehensive and coordinated approach by groups ranging from healthcare professionals to teachers, faith communities, and economic development authorities who have all seen the impact of homelessness on children, classrooms, and communities. For Paris, the young girl in the video, and for thousands of young people who aren't here today but will sleep in cars, crowded churches, and overflowing shelters tonight, I'd appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Quapla. I'm assuming Paris is in class today.
Yes.
Good. Wish her our best.
We will. Thank you.
Jennifer Erdman, is that correct?
That is correct.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I work for Lakes and Pines Community
Action. And state your name for the record again.
My name is Jennifer Erdman, and I work for Lakes and Pines Community Action Agency out of Mora. And I wanted to come and kind of represent the service area that we serve. We serve Aiken, Carlton, Mille Lacs, Kennebec, Chisago, Pine, and Isanti counties. And so I wanted to share some of our data that we're collecting from our service area. So from we receive Minnesota Department of Human Services Office of Economic Opportunity funding for homeless shelters. So from September 2011 through January 2013, which was 6 months short of our two-year grant cycle, we served 22 low-income households with emergency motel stays. These households consisted of 52 individuals, 9 households without children, and 13 households with children. Total of children in that group were 23 under the age of 18. The following 6 months, you know, because we still needed to serve homeless folks, we used some of our funds that we'd intended for education, transportation, and some of the food programs. We pulled funding from there for the remaining 6 months. So from January 2013 to June 2013, we were able to serve an additional 14 households, which included 13 children. So on an average from 2 years ago, our average motel stay was about 7 days. Currently, our average is 17 days. So we're having a great difficulty in finding housing for our homeless families. Transitional, we have no programs in our service area. So if funding were to come through from the state of Minnesota, we would be able to use those four transitional housing programs, assist homeless families, individuals, find, maintain permanent housing. As of this past October, because we have been working with a lot of our local school districts, we're hearing about a lot of homeless youth, couch hopping youth, youth sleeping in their vehicles. We have begun a program, a host home program, modeling after Avenues for Homeless Youth. But we have young people sleeping in their vehicles, couch hopping all the time. Some other information I brought with we have two shelters in our service area. We have one in Pine City. It's called a Place for You shelter. They have been open for 4 months. Since they opened, they've housed 21 residents, 13 from Pine County, 5 from Chisago County, 2 from Kennebec, and 1 from Mille Lacs County. Average length of stay is 36 days. For the month of January, they turned away 19 individuals due to capacity. February, they turned away 20 individuals. Currently, they have 7 residents, 3 of which are working and 3 are in school. That shelter is just for adults. They do not take children. The other shelter I wanted to share information from was from New Pathways out of Cambridge. They collaborate with 20 local area churches to provide shelter, kind of a round-robin effect. They one church to the next each week. And they have 710 volunteers to make that operration go. They served 35 families in 2012. Turned away 92 families due to capacity. 74 families did not qualify to enter their program. And the average length of stay was 58 days. Their outcome was 95% leave for permanent housing. So if we have that opportunity to serve our families and our youth and our adults better with some ongoing programming, there are some measurable outcomes. There's some success there. So I just wanted to share. Thank you for letting me do that. Our area, we have no youth shelters. We have 2 shelters. It's a very large service area. And we could really use some help. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Erdman. I was there at the opening of the Pine City shelter just a few months ago and have been tracking their work, and it's good to have some resources somewhere between Duluth and the Twin Cities.
Absolutely.
And appreciate your I'm curious, you know, I know Aiken and Carlton and Pine were all affected with the flood last year. Has that really increased the need in that region for have you seen?
It has. What we're finding, we've certainly served in my department that I work in, it's emergency housing, and we've certainly served a number of those folks that have lost their homes. But what we're seeing dramatically is that there is a shortage of housing itself. There's nowhere to put folks. You know, we're they're going into hotels. They're staying into the hotel longer until they find housing. And oftentimes it becomes unaffordable housing just because of that shortage. So we have received some federal funding that we've been using to provide shallow subsidies, you know, to attempt to get them into stable housing. But it's very difficult. There's a great shortage of affordable housing.
Thank you. Rich Hooks with Hearth Connections, is that correct?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Richard Hooks Wayman, and I serve as the executive director of Hearth Connection. We are a statewide nonprofit organization that's dedicated to ending long-term homelessness. We established a series of network of supportive housing programs in three regional collaboratives that focus on individuals that have experienced long periods of homelessness, typically staying outside or in shelters for more than a year or having several episodes of homelessness over the last several years. I'm here today to talk to you about the fact that this bill supports a continuum of services, as Liz has stated, and part of that continuum is people that experience long-term homelessness. I want this committee to hear that we have programs that work to end homelessness, and we know data and research actually bolsters those findings. If you do not know, Hearth Connection started as a research pilot in 1999 to work with people that experience long-term homelessness. And we published a report in 2007 after doing a research pilot from 2001 to 2007 with households that were experiencing homelessness in shelter and outdoor sleeping. That pilot program proved that we were able to take people with long histories of homelessness and stabilize them in supportive housing. And we also shifted public costs. We shifted costs from costly institutions and crisis emergency services to more preventative and necessary routine health care. And we've used that research to bolster other research pilots here in the Minnesota area. Recently, Hearth Connection has partnered with Guild Incorporated and Regents Hospital, right next door here, to look at people that were frequent users of their emergency rooms that also were experiencing homelessness. This pilot is called the Hospital to Home Pilot, and we took simply seven people, a very small cohort of people that were experiencing repeat usages in the emergency room, and we provided them with supportive housing. And we tracked their progress over the last 2 years. Even though this is a first look in a very small pilot, those seven individuals showed an 80% decrease in their usage of the emergency room after they became stabilized in housing, and they also saw a decrease in their hospitalization. Likewise, even with Hearth Connection's local research and data, we know from national data that supportive housing works to end long-term homelessness and provides cost benefit. Research from Denver to Rhode Island and Massachusetts has shown that when you take frequent users of systems, whether it be emergency rooms, hospitals, detox, and jails, and couple of that with stable housing for people that experience homelessness, you see cost savings ranging from $8,000 to $30,000 per participant. This is national research that we're seeing across the nation that should bolster our efforts to invest in these worthwhile programs. In addition, I'd like to say that we're also making progress. Despite the recession and the increases in homelessness that Senator Claussen has mentioned today, we have seen progress. The downtown Minneapolis area in the last 4 years alone has decreased its street homelessness by over 50% due to investments by the downtown congregations and investment in permanent supportive housing. Likewise, nationally, because of efforts to address veteran homelessness, we have seen a decrease of 17% in the number of homeless veterans nationwide because of our incremental investments in supportive housing. So piggybacking on what Liz has said, I would like this committee to know we know it works, and as programs, we are doing a better job of integrating housing with health care services, which I think is a win for both our efforts to improve health care outcomes as well as our efforts to end homelessness. I feel that this bill is an opportunity for this committee to alleviate human suffering. There is no reason that children should be sleeping in a shelter tonight, and there is no justification that adults with disabilities have to sleep in tents tonight. I hope that you'll support this continuum of services, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have about Hearth Connection and our access to data and research. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hooks-Wyman. Questions of the committee? All right. Quite a conversation. I mean, I think we've said a lot about the needs on the last bill and on this one. Thank you for the testimony. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to make a couple comments. Senator Rosen was talking about the silos that are being created, you know, inside of our issue area here in Health and Human Services and in this area, and trying to break down some of those silos. And I think, too, we need to consider the silos or the compartmentalization of different issue areas within our budget. For instance, talking about education, how this benefits education to make sure that these children are provided with stability and are provided with resources they need to come to school prepared and well nourished and fed sometimes I think we lose sight of that too, and there's a lot of investment that's going to be made into education on the achievement gap, trying to address that problem, and it's not going to go very far if we don't also address this side of it. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's just important for us to be aware of that as we move forward. Criminal justice, another area that obviously this affects greatly. I think it's in California where they try to determine how much prison space they're going to need in the future based on how many students are ready to read in third grade, I believe it is. So here again, you know, we see the connection. So just wanted to be aware of that and just point that out. So, and thank you for what you're doing, Senator Claussen, and very important area.
Thank you, Senator Eakin.
Mr. Chair, may I address the education point for just 1 minute?
Yes.
The University of Minnesota partnered with Hearth Connection, Wilder, and Lutheran Social Services in actually studying families that were experiencing homelessness and the outcomes for children related after they became stabilized in housing. That study was just published last year, and it showed, of course, something that we thought it would show, which was that once the families became stabilized, children became much less likely to experience school mobility, and we also saw small gains in some of their test scores in some of the grade areas as well. The look at that particular study was a very short period of time, and we're hoping to extend that with the University of Minnesota. But we agree that there's savings that can be obtained and better outcomes for education with housing as well for children.
Right. And, I mean, the way I phrase the same point oftentimes is, you know, I mean, there comes a point of diminishing returns. If you fund one area of the state budget to the exclusion of another and we don't care for our children and make sure they have stable places to live and that they have a healthy environment to go home to be able to do their homework, it just doesn't work. And there comes a point of diminishing returns in our investments in education, which are, of course, critical investments in the future of Minnesota, but it has to be balanced in a whole package. With that, Senator Claussen moves that Senate File 797 be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion.
Senator Lurie, may I,
Senator
before you
Sharon
move forward,
has some
just
comments. Senator
just
Sharon.
Not a comment, it's a question. And I know the time is really important, but could Senator Claussen or a member of the group, we've heard the other bill on youth homelessness for $8 million, and then there's a series of appropriations here. Can you help me understand the relationship between these two and how these are either duplicative or, you know, help me understand the relationship of these two bills to each other?
Yes, Senator, I'd be happy to speak to that. The Homeless Youth Act is inside this ask, and so it's part of this $25 million ask, is the same $8 million. There were a couple policy changes we wanted to do in the homeless youth piece, and so we want, you know, we ran that one separately, and there's, you know, separate constituencies and stuff working on it. But all of us in the Homes for All Coalition support the Homeless Youth Act. It's part of this.
Okay, thank you.
And related to that, if I might, the, you know, we've talked some about, you know, making sure the services work together. Many of the service providers in the room provide services to all of these populations, the long-term homeless, the families, the youth, and they're kind of making this work every day. And so we really look to them for their wisdom. And then in other communities like the Fargo-Moorhead Homeless Coalition, they meet on a regular basis to figure out who's, you know, who can take the youth, who can take the families, who can take the adults, and make sure that we're really using these resources as wisely as possible. And so I'm very proud to be a part of this movement, I guess, effort.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was a comment made actually with Senator Dibble's bill, and that had to do with aging out of foster care. Could you address that a bit? Because sometimes I also in this reading about the stability. So if somebody has stability in a foster care situation, but they age out, and only because of that they're leaving that environment, it seems like one piece of it sometimes can be in that area. Is that being addressed, Mr. Chair, in some other way, or is there proposals for that, or a study, or that being looked at? Just if you could just speak to that topic in general.
Thank you, Senator and
Mr. Hooks-Wayman.
And Chairman, you may not know, besides directing Hearth Connection, I also used to direct the StreetWorks Collaborative. And this issue has been nationally researched, so I want you to know that there was a national study of foster care systems that included children out of the Midwest, and what that study showed was that when youth age out of foster care at age 18 or 19 or 20, depending on the state, about 1 in 4 became homeless within the first 12 months of their leaving care from foster care. In response to that, the federal government did enact something called the Fostering Connections to Success Act, which is a federal program that is supposed to providing resources to the state in order to help youth stay in foster care, remain in school. Those dollars are limited, unfortunately, and so it doesn't serve all of the foster children. I'm a foster parent and an adoptive parent here in the state of Minnesota, so I know that those monies don't serve all the youth aging out of foster care, but it is a start, and this Department of Human Services does have units and staff dedicated to making sure that kids that are aging out of foster care don't end up in homelessness, but the resources are stretched and it simply doesn't go far enough is my quick answer to that question.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and just in a follow-up to that, do we have a cost basis between, you know, the cost of continuing in foster care versus other alternatives? Most other children are in that situation, still have home as a resource. You know, they have a stability base there, even though they may be away at college or something like that, but there is a connection there. Do we have anything? Maybe you might have that as well.
You know, Mr. Chair?
Senator Claussen.
You know, I'm not aware of, you know, a study that's being conducted or has, but I know that we do have a emerging adult bill that's in process. It's a Senate file that's being heard, and that does deal with aging out of foster care citizens in Minnesota. So there is a bill to work on that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. On Senator Claussen's motion that Senate File 797 be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Claussen.
Thank you.
And now, Senator Claussen, are you ready for your next bill as well, Senate File 1078?
Center on child.
That's okay.
Center against studies and child welfare. It's up to him.
While Senator Claussen gets ready to present the next bill, maybe I will suggest to members that we do have a, you know, I don't know, 15 bills plus some discussion about specific items within the omnibus bill proposed by the governor. I'm hoping to maybe run past our 11 o'clock since we don't have session today. if members are able to. If we lose a quorum and it's not working for us, we will recess until 6, as was published. But if members are able to free up a little bit of time on their calendar, again, these are incredibly important conversations, and I really value the work that we do in this committee. And we're just looking for a few more minutes here and there where we can squeeze them out. On that, Senator Rosen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And to those comments, I think it would be helpful to for the testifiers to make sure that they point — this is the Budget Committee — to point out, I think, Senator Sharon's comments about how does this relate to the previous bill are really important. You know, explain the budget, where that's going, how these dollars are going to be spent, and so we can zero in on that. Because a lot of these bills have been heard in policy, maybe not for everybody, but...
That's true.
Yeah. So I would just like to focus on the dollars.
A good reminder that we are the Budget Committee, and Senator Sharon and many of us did hear these in the Policy Committee. And believe that they do represent good policy, and it comes to whether or not we can fit them within the target that today stands at $150 million cut from the base. Becomes pretty challenging at times when we put this together, but maybe we should try to focus a little bit more on the budget in order to, you know, make sure that we use our time efficiently and get through that. With those comments, Senator Claussen, Senate File 1078.
Once again, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity to meet with you regarding Senate File 1078, which is a request for an appropriation to a nonprofit organization, Advocating Change Together. For 34 years, Advocating Change Together has been assisting and advocating for Minnesota citizens with developmental disabilities. Advocating Change Together supports the 6 statewide regions of the South Advocates Minnesota Network, which in the past has been supported by a contract with the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, DEED. And at this time, I'd like you to meet Mary Kay Kennedy. She's co-executive director of Advocating Change Together, who will share with you the needs of the organization. Thank you.
Ms. Kennedy, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record one more time. I know it's redundant, but...
Thank you. My name is Mary Kay Kennedy, and I'm the co-executive director of Advocating Change Together, or ACT. And ACT is a disability organization run by and for persons with developmental disabilities. The mission at ACT is about what we call self-advocacy. And self-advocacy is a movement of individuals and groups working to empower people with disabilities to speak for themselves, make their own decisions, and stand up for their own rights. The work that we do reduces the isolation that people with disabilities often experience, and the work we do gives them the knowledge and tools they need to take some greater control of their lives. Just briefly, a little bit about ACT. Our work at ACT interfaces with the broader disability community in Minnesota. We work with ARC Minnesota, the Centers for Independent Living. I've got a list here of about 15 different organizations that we work, but I'll just highlight a few. The Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, University of Minnesota Institute on Community Integration. So we're definitely a part of a larger system in Minnesota of groups working on disability issues. ACT is a 2-time winner of the Minnesota Council on Nonprofit Mission Award. And in fact, over our 34-year history, we've received about 19 different state and national awards for our work in advancing disability as a human and civil rights issue. These awards have come from disability organizations such as the State Council on Disability, as well as groups outside of the disability, such as the Catholic Campaign for Human Development. So I mention this just partly because we're proud of it, and we just feel that this represents to us that our work is valued in the broader community. ACT plays a leadership role in the metro area, state, a national leadership role, and even an international leadership role in disability rights. The focus of my testimony today is on ACT's leadership role at a state level. Minnesota has a solid structure for promoting and implementing self-advocacy throughout the state. I think everyone should have a copy of ACT's annual report. And if you go to page pages 8 through 11, this is where it talks about this SAM structure. SAM is a program administered by Advocating Change Together, and SAM stands for Self-Advocates Minnesota. This network of groups enables ACT to work strategically to reach people with disabilities throughout the state. On page 11, you'll see a little map that divides the state into six different regions. Each of those regions has a host agency, which in these six, it's a small ARC chapter, and they hire part-time facilitators to do the work of empowerment for people with disabilities. So a report to DEED covering a six-month period showed that we reached about 2,000 people within that six-month period through this network. And in 2012, the SAM regions conducted 114 training sessions, reaching roughly 3,600 individuals. So it's really a fabulous network in terms of its ability to reach a lot of the people throughout the state. It's sometimes hard to evaluate the work, but we try our best. And if you'll look on page 18 of our annual report, it just gives a little bit of the evaluation results. We've contracted with the University of Minnesota to do an external evaluation of our program, and we also are always listening to the regions in terms of reporting specific changes they're seeing in the lives of people with disabilities. So my testimony today has to do with how ACT is supported to be a leader within this network. Our role with the network was supported by a contract with DEED between 2006 and 2012. DEED's interest in this network really had to do with providing a vehicle for ACT to meet contract obligations. So DEED was involved with the launching, establishing this network and launching it back in 2006 and 2007. Our contract with DEED was discontinued due to some restructuring and how grants were administered through DEED. So we no longer have that support. And at the bottom of page 11, you'll also see that in addition to the DEED money being discontinued, we have a $50,000 appropriation through DHS, which ends in June of 2013. So due to these changes in public funding over the past year, ACT is now using some of our operating reserve to fund what we hope to be a short-term revenue gap. While we are positioned fairly well for short-term revenue gaps, we're not positioned well for long periods of time without public support being a part of our mix. We're a big believer in a diversified funding base, and we're an organization that does a lot of work with earned income, mission-driven earned income to support some of our work, and we have a long history of philanthropic support in the state. But we believe that again, public funding is critical to our funding mix, and this is the reason that we're here today asking for a $310,000 investment that we're asking you to consider in self-advocacy. So I just would briefly again say over the next 2 years, we're going to really work to further diversify our funding mix with a goal of better balance between public, philanthropic, and earned. So what exactly would we do with $310,000? So I'll give you that answer very specifically. We would use $120,000 over a two-year period to conduct our trainings throughout the state, support curriculum development, and contract out for evaluation. We would use $100,000 to support our role with the SAM network that we talked about, to bring together people throughout the state for quarterly meetings. We actually go out to the regions and attend their regional gatherings, and we also administer a statewide conference every odd-numbered year. And $90,000 of the request would go to support some of ACT's general operating needs, including audit, IT supports, phone, and a part of a full-time equivalent to support administration of programs, managing the contract and contracts and submitting reports. So I thank you very much for this opportunity to address the committee, and your support would make a difference in the lives of people with disabilities throughout the state. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Kennedy. I know that we're the SAM advocates and the work of ACT is very well known among, in the Capitol, at least amongst our members. I know we've met with many of the trained advocates that have come out of your programs. Mr. Cardenas, did you have comments to add?
Yes, I'd, Rick Cardenas with advocating Change Together. Yes, and I know I've been in front of the committee many times, and I hope it's not the last. I wanted to point out that we do these trainings from everywhere, from New Ulm all the way up to Duluth and points in between Mankato, and we have a new one coming up in St. Cloud at the end of May. We're doing participating in a SAM regional. Now, I hope not to confuse the SAM with this separate funding, because the SAM is more of a pass-through, and we fund those regions with individuals that try to establish and maintain self-advocacy organizations in all of the regions. And those regions that are indicated in the annual report are not the precise lines. We develop the regions just about here and about there, but generally southeast, southwest, northeast, northwest, and central. The only SAM that is not funded is the Metro SAM, and we use our operating funds to do workshops and conferences within the metro area, and we have one coming up this Friday, actually, at the Black Bear Crossings at Como. So if you want to spend your Friday over there instead of in front of this committee, just please come on over. I won't be here, but you can come and see me. So thank you very much, and hope you consider this in our bill.
Thank you. Any questions of members? Anyone else in the audience wish to testify either in favor or in opposition? Seeing none, Senator Claussen moves that Senate File 1078 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Claussen. Thank you for your testimony. Senator Marty is next on the agenda. I know I saw him here a little bit ago, and I know he had members travel from Rochester. So we'd like to get him in the morning. They're looking for him. As I work through the agenda, I see. Okay. Senator Hayden has about a dozen bills after that. And he's not here. And then I see I have one I wasn't expecting till tonight.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty.
Senator Marty's here. Oh, good. Thank goodness.
Mr. Chair, that's the best welcome I've had in a committee. That's much better than oh, no.
Yes. All right. Senate File 449, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 449 is simply a bill that would request funding for a pilot project for the Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center, just nearby my district. Mr. Chair, given the way redistricting hit me last time, next time, who knows, maybe it'll be in my district. But the Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center, which is a community mental health center, they are finding very, very high percentage, like 3/4 of their patients have other medical conditions, serious ones, to the extent that they have, I think it's one ambulance trip there every other day, more than that in the last few years, for people going to emergency room and other things. They're trying to coordinate more coordinated medical care to address more needs of people, and they're asking for funding to provide some clinic integration managers. unlike in some of the bigger counties where they may try something like this, the funding savings from the lack of emergency room use and the hospitalization would go to the people who are putting this in place. The savings here would go to the state from medical assistance. They'd go to some of the hospitals and others, but not to the clinic and so on. And they can't afford to do this, but when you're having an ambulance come out to your medical center to pick somebody up for other medical serious crisis problems, every other day we ought to be trying something like this. And I have both our former colleague and current County Commissioner Sheila Cascaden here and Dave Cook from the Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center.
Who wishes to go first? Mr. Cook, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
State your name. And
David Cook. I'm the CEO at Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today about the importance of the funding proposal for two clinical integration managers, which would be the hub of our integrated care model at Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center. Since 1966, Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center has provided mental health and chemical dependency services to the underserved and underinsured individuals who are typically covered under Medicaid or Medicare in Olmsted and Fillmore counties. In fact, 84% of our client base is Medicaid or Medicare. Medicaid does not currently adequately reimburse for care coordination services, which is why we're seeking funding for these positions. In the past 2 years, we have begun a process to transform and expand our services to an integrated health home model. We've been researching the needs of our clients and have come to understand that they frequently do not successfully access critical services like primary care. We also know that individuals with a chronic mental illness who do not successfully access primary care and other medical support services die 25 years earlier than the rest of the population, as many of you are aware with the Robert Woods Johnson Foundation study in 2011. Let me give you an example of a current client who is unable to successfully coordinate and receive the services she needs that we see at Zumbro Valley. 54-year-old female, I'll call Jane. Her mental health problems include major depression, PTSD, anxiety disorder, currently living with her daughter because she's unable to live on her own. She's been suicidal since her son committed suicide 2 years ago. Her medical comorbid problems include COPD, type 2 diabetes, extremely high cholesterol, stage 3 heart disease, morbidly obese, and osteoarthritis. She's on 8 different medications, can't ride the bus because of her anxiety and arthritis. She's currently seen every day either by primary care or at Zumbro Valley. Unless she's accompanied by one of our psychiatric nurses, which is not reimbursed, she will usually not attend her primary care appointment. And if she doesn't go and we're not there with her, the communication about the appointment is delayed. If we had a clinical integration manager in primary care on site, we could provide the management services for this person to stabilize her condition, maximize communication among providers, and coordinate her medications. In the past 2 years, we have added an on-site pharmacy to increase medication compliance. And also in cooperation with Appletree Dental Services, our clients have access to dental services on-site almost every day now. Thanks to a grant from Mayo Clinic, we have worked with an advisory group of medical and community partners, including the Department of Human Services and Department of Health, to develop our business plan to add primary care services to our continuum of care. Let me tell you more about why. 70 to 75% of our psychiatric clients have a comorbid medical condition that is not being treated regularly in primary care. Due to many social factors, most of these clients do not successfully access primary care services. We had 189 ambulance visits to Zumbro Valley in 2011, and in 2012 there were 179, some medical, some mental health, or chemical health. The lack of primary care services on site results in many of these clients seeking acute care, of course, in the emergency room, which is very costly and may result in higher levels of care that could be avoided. We estimate that a primary or the emergency room visit along with an ambulance visit is somewhere around $2,500. If we could reduce that number by 50%, we could easily pay for this program. Cost savings to the state. The funding for the clinical integration manager is stage one of our project to add primary care services. These positions will assess all new clients to Zumbro Valley, determine risk level, personally connect them to providers at Zumbro Valley, lead the care coordination weekly meetings that will include all providers, including involved with high-risk cases, whether they're the primary care provider, mental health, psychiatry, case management, chemical health, dental and pharmacy to assess progress. So we will choose four or five high-risk cases and determine, is this person making progress? What do we need to do to make changes if necessary to get back on track? Coordinate services internally and externally to address the high needs of the client and track progress on their care plan through our electronic medical record. Stage two of the project is the on-site build-out for the clinic, and stage three is beginning operations of the primary care services. Thank you for your time to speak to this important initiative. I stand ready for questions.
Thank you. Mr. Cook, we'll maybe take Sheila's Kiskaden's testimony next. You know, one of the things that I'm going to be asking is, I know that you know, the savings that can be generated off of this is a big piece of the pitch, and I actually believe that this type of model really can produce that type of savings. I'm wondering if Senator Marty, you've approached the Department of Human Services to see if they can
document it, Mr. Chair.
Book any savings. That certainly would go a long way toward helping us fit this within an incredibly difficult target that we have. So you can think about that a little bit. Maybe Senator Kiskaden can offer her testimony and touch on that and see if we can make any progress on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be back in this room where I spent many hours and see some familiar faces anyway. I am currently an Olmsted County Commissioner elected last fall and am here today representing the Olmsted County Board. Now, Olmsted County and Rochester, we don't think of as rural, but really we are more like a rural community in some ways than the metro area. We are a resource-rich area in some ways. And I know we're before you for a lot of ideas this year. But let me just say, for those of you who have underserved communities, for those of you in rural Minnesota, for those of you who are concerned about healthcare homes and a way to reduce costs, I think that this is a promising model for looking at how we can provide better access for those who have chronic and persistent mental illness to a medical home that then can provide a healthcare home, that then can provide the wraparound services that they need to stay healthy, both mentally healthy, their mental illness, and their physical health. There are two projects I want to call out to you that are similar in Minnesota that are examining the same questions. The ICSI received a grant for nine states to look at how to deal through their Compass Project with patients who have depression and have other kind of illnesses, and they're looking at what they call patient activators to be their solution. Courage Center, you may have heard about the work that they did creating a healthcare home for the patients with multiple disabilities who are their patients. And what did they find in their experiment? What they found was that they had a substantial reduction in hospitalizations, a substantial reduction in ER visits. And more importantly, maybe, the patients reported more days of feeling, having better healthcare days, better satisfaction. So if you look at the triple aim of healthcare costs, and patient satisfaction, and benchmarking on outcomes, that process was successful. I think this is a different population. There's people with chronic and persistent mental illness. And for those of us who don't have the full range of services that the metro area has, we know this is an underserved population everywhere. And if we can experiment and demonstrate the efficacy of a model where we provide primary care in a mental health setting, I think that it will have benefit throughout the state, and I think we can learn from that. And I agree with Senator Lori's observation that we should be thinking about how would we track and book the savings. But I would guess that this model, we are going to find, like many, you have to demonstrate it. It takes a while to get it up and running, and you're not going to find the savings in this biennium. But I think it does need to be evaluated.
Mr. Chair.
Can I add?
Mr. Cook?
Something. Yes. I just would like the committee to know, and Mr. Chair, that we are working with Mayo and Olmsted County to get some data on total cost of care of a pilot group of patients of 25 at this point that we believe high utilizers on the mental health and medical side, so that we can get a baseline to track outcomes going forward over this two-year period. Once we have the total cost of care, I think we can start measuring how we're able to reduce those dollars over this two-year period if we're able to put this model into place. We were hoping to have some of that data before this hearing, but we weren't able to get that, but we will in the next month or so. So I think will be very informative to us and to everyone involved to see how can we start reducing some of those dollars, especially since 84% of our population is Medicaid, Medicare, savings to the state.
Senator Marty?
Mr. Chair, and to your question earlier, yes, I have not approached DHS about it, and I know how hard it is to track these, but, again, it is the medical assistance funds mm-hmm. of the state that would be the largest savings, and so I right. They're there. It's just, as you know, the difficulty of measuring it, but I will be in touch with them as well.
Yeah. You know, and I'm just brainstorming here, but another approach, if we aren't able to fit this within our target, you know, I know DHS is working on the healthcare delivery system projects and still interested in working with groups that want to create these and provide those flexible ways to approach specific targeted populations. It might be of interest for additional avenues to pursue to prove up this model. I do think it is of great value, as demonstrated by my co-authorship of this bill. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and very nice to see you, Commissioner Giskane. Do you call you Commissioner or Senator? I'm not sure what you're sure.
I guess it's Commissioner now.
Is it? I probably am about the only one in this room that was serving besides Senator Marty at the time. But my question to you, and it's actually to Senator Marty, is have or to Commissioner Mr. Cook, there are other programs out there such as the Chemical Health Navigation Program, Senate File 469, which has been around. It's a pilot program that many counties in your area have collaborated with specifically on chemical health and having the ability to use those dollars in many ways to serve exactly what they were talking about, Mr. Chair. And so I was wondering if the clinic has participated in that program, if you're working with the county on that level, because that is showing some wonderful results too.
It really is, and yes, we
Mr.
are.
Mr. Cook.
In fact, we're employing the staff who are involved in that CD pilot project. So it's our staff that are going out and working with that group, and as you say, seeing some tremendous reductions in ER visits and detox, in being able to get connected to housing, more permanent housing. So we are very involved in that and very excited about and hopeful about that program continuing in the future.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
If Senator Rosen is done.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, when it comes to these savings, I've heard this in quite a few committees. Are you able or do you have any documentation in regards to dollar amounts? In other words, say you had a client who you're quite positive might otherwise have gone to the emergency room. We can probably extrapolate a cost mm-hmm. and instead was treated in this sort of way. Do you have any of that sort of documentation?
Well, we know that
Mr.
an ambulance
Cook.
Visit
The conversations come through the chair.
I'm sorry.
Fine, Mr. Cook.
We know that the combination of the ambulance visit and the ER visit is about $2,500. So we know, you know, what kind of savings we can see there. What I've spoken with the primary care physicians at Mayo Clinic, and I'll give you an example of what we're trying to get to, is that when an individual tries to, one of our clients tries to seek primary care, they go in and the primary care physician, of course, is looking at the symptom of what they're coming in with. All these other things come up, and they say, why don't you go back to Zumbro Valley, and they can talk with you about those. Whereas if we had this on site, you know, the therapist then or the primary care person could say, let's go down and talk with your therapist about that or your case manager, and it's right on site. So I think that's the great benefit of having this process in place, this integrated care model where everybody's coming to it. It's a one-stop shop to, you know, access all those services.
Commissioner Cascaden?
Senator Kiffmeyer, mm-hmm. I think that we don't have the documentation that you're looking for now. We'd like to launch this program, and we would be tracking, because we do have that caseload of 25 where we have assistance, technical assistance from health statisticians to help us look at that caseload and see what the differences are. But let me just and I wish I had it memorized what the cost savings were that they saw from Courage Center. It was pretty substantial by doing that wraparound. The other tricky part is you don't know what cost avoidance you have by the patient who is maybe scheduled for surgery but doesn't make it that day, scheduled for an appointment but doesn't show up. And so there's hidden costs when you have these patients that are difficult to manage, whose lives are not as predictable as an average patient. So there's some hidden costs into healthcare systems, as well as those ambulance costs, those emergency room visits that could be avoided, the appointments that are scheduled, as he described this particular woman, who she just doesn't show up. That has a cost to the healthcare system as well. So I think we do need to do. I wish we were before you saying these are our estimated cost savings, but since this project is kind of in the very, we'd like to launch it, and we're not at the full. We're at the very beginning of the launch. It's sort of like seed money to get this launched. We don't have accurate predictions for you.
Mr. Chair,
Senator,
to follow up on that, thank you. I think that as folks come before us, they frequently, though, will claim a savings. Or I think to say a hypothetical savings would be accurate, or, you know, you can kind of have an educated sense of hearing those, but I think every project that then has this sort of funding should be included in that requirement, though, some data collection that it may not be perfect, doesn't have to be. We understand some of those factors. That's why you call them footnotes sometimes and saying this does not include some of these things, because I think it would be very helpful going forward to have that instead of funded, we hope so, nothing is ever followed through, and then we tend to have another claim a year later, and it makes it really hard. So I think if this funding, I think this is being laid over for possible inclusion, there may be something that might be included in all of these, you know, some sort of language that would include a requirement to keep track of that and some sort of report or documentation. After all, that's the statement made. I think all I'm looking for is some follow-through and accountability for that statement.
Senator Kiffmeyer, on lines 1.9 and 1.10, they did attempt to address that. It doesn't come back to the legislature, but the grant recipient here must report measurable outcomes and savings to the Commissioner of Human Services by January 15th, 2016. I mean, we could maybe have that report delivered to the legislature as well, if you wanted. And as you mentioned, it would be laid over for possible inclusion. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if we want to get that language added today.
Yeah, I see that, Mr. Chairman, and I saw that in that sort of way, and that's why I mention it, because I think also when you talk about booking savings, that's why the department never wants to do that, because it is hypothetical. It is a hope for, and those are very difficult for them later on. Although sometimes I think if there was a number and that the entities who wish to try this sort of a program would take on the responsibility of delivering that savings in some way, it might be easier to do that. But just more of a comment, and I know that when you hold things over for possible inclusion, you can sometimes adjust those as it comes forward in the next level.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, did I see you had a question or not?
Well, I was wondering, it's Sharon. A similar question to the last couple of bills on homelessness, and that is, can you help me understand how this is different than or not replicating the Navigator program, and why is the Navigator program not the approach that you're using? Mm-hmm. You're involved in it, but why is this supplemental to that? And my second question is, I guess I won't go with my second question. I'll stick with that one.
Okay. Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, thank you for that question. I think it's different in a couple of ways. We do serve a broad range of clients, and part of that is the homeless community. And the chemical dependency community, of course. And so that's the group of clients that we work with primarily in the CD project, in the pilot project. With this project, we're talking about an SPMI population coming into Zumbro Valley, referrals from the county or other places to do case management or provide other kinds of services. More comprehensive, we're going to reach many more patients this way. We see about 5,000 patients a year. We have about 1,900 active patients at any time. So all of those that need this clinical integration manager services will go through this person or these two people, get a full assessment, and see what kinds of services they need. The CD pilot might be part of that, or they may be receiving some services, but there'll be a broader range of services within Zumbro Valley as well that they'll receive, the primary care, the dental, the, you know, all those coordinated services on site. Right now, a lot of those CD pilot services are served out in the community where those navigators go out and meet with individuals, you know, out in the rural areas. This would be, more consolidated on our campus and more comprehensive.
And then one follow-up question.
Senator Sharon.
I understand that the program allows an eligible center, which you would be, to use chemical dependency funds for not just treatment but for other services as well, if I understand that correctly, that it expands flexibility for how you use CD funds is what the request asks for. First, is that accurate? And second, one of the reasons we want flexibility in spending is to be able to do things like you're talking about. But the flip side of that is, for me, would be concerns. I want to be assured that services for those that are chemically dependent, need chemical dependency services, find themselves now not having the resources for chemical dependency services, which is what we wanted to happen with these dollars.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner Cascaden.
Because Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center is involved in two projects, we're starting to confuse the two. This particular request has nothing to do with the CD flexibility bill. That's a separate issue, and we're not asking to access those funds directly for this project.
Okay.
This funding is to fund the beginning of a primary care clinical setting within a community mental health center, starting with the care coordinators. Those care coordinators would work individually with those patients. Some of those patients may access the CD funds, but we're not seeking to use them. We do think the CD funds need to be very flexible to get the maximum benefit for those funds at the community level.
Yeah, this request, as I read it, is the annual cost of two clinical integration managers is $230,000, and the request is for those two, $460,000 for the biennium. You'd have those two clinical managers, and that's exactly what this request is and allows you to move forward with your implementation of this pilot.
phase one of developing an integrated, fully integrated primary care clinic within a mental health center.
Great. Senator Hayden?
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's not a question. It's more of a comment that, you know, I've worked on some of these projects over the years. In particular, I've worked even with you guys in an integrated fashion. And one of the things that we found is that I think it's important to think about booking savings and talking about that we think this will save money down the line for the clients that we serve. But I would just caution us to think about this in a slightly different way, especially with the clients that you serve, the SPMI and those folks. Often they may not get better per se. Right, we might be able to manage their conditions. They might have a better quality of life, but the idea that somehow that they will get better to the point that we can figure out how to book that into a savings because they'll need less services may or may not happen depending upon who the person is. I'd rather kind of look at it as we're spending dollars much more wisely, and that we're, as opposed to ending up in emergency room visits, detox, jail, other places, that we spend a lot of money with these folks, that they can be much more integrated in the community. But that still costs us something. Mm-hmm. And we still may have to expend those dollars. And so I think we think about the work that we do and trying to save as much money as we can. And I think that's important. But I also think that we have to understand that we're dealing with people and people who have conditions that they are going to have to live with for the rest of their lives. So the question is, how do we spend our dollars? And do we do it in a way that we think is much more valuable for society, much more valuable for them? You know, in the region that you guys live in, I know that a lot of the business leaders like the work that you're doing, even though you're spending money because it's keeping them out of the corridors and places in which doesn't do well for business. But you guys are also providing them a high quality of life that allows people to try to live in a way that I think we all think that this society should care for folks. So I guess what I'm saying in a nutshell is it is important to think about booking savings and to do things in a way that save us money. But I think we also have to think about it in terms of the quality of life and the services that we deliver. And can we do it in a way that allows people to live a much better quality of life than what they're living today in this fragmented system that we have?
Senator Marty,
Mr. Chair, I think it is both improving quality of life, and I think while, again, providing the services aren't free, it is less expensive in many of these cases, and that's why the savings we think are there. The savings of providing the care in a more efficient manner than the emergency room. And back quickly, I think Senator Kiffmeyer's point is right, and we want to have this well evaluated and done and maybe in process, if this does make it into the omnibus bill, getting tighter language to make sure that the whole point of this is to study how it works out, and we want to make sure that's reported clearly.
And to use it as a pilot to demonstrate the value to expand to other regions and use this as a way to improve people's lives. And truthfully, I mean, one of the reasons that we need to track the savings is so that they don't just go into the black hole, and that so that we can do proof of concept that allows us to the flexibility to make these strategic investments. But point well taken about making sure that we not lose the human aspect of it as well. With that, any other questions of the committee? Anyone else in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 449? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 449 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Senator Marty, are you ready for your next bill as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senate File 980. And this bill,
Senator Marty,
this bill deals with changing the TEFRA parental contribution amounts back to where they were a couple years ago. I think it's three, four years ago is a budget fix. We increased the TEFRA parent contributions, and and for a 3-year period, which is what was agreed to, and then it was extended again. And this seeks to undo that extension. It would save parents about $1.2 million. It would cost the state about half that, because it's obviously half state and half federal. The TEFRA program, for I think most members of the committee are fully aware of what it is, but it's is for parents of children with disabilities who are serious needs that would be on medical assistance, but the parents' income is too high for that. They qualify for this. I think about 10 years ago, we significantly upped the parental contribution fees. And these parents on the program, they have to keep their own health insurance underlying this, but the medical assistance for their child on top of that. Not only are in many cases one of the parents staying out of the workforce because they are taking care of the child, they also have many other expenses in addition to this, often dietary or other uncovered services and so on, plus their own medical expenses, plus everything else, and it's becoming a great hardship. In the policy committee, we had testimony from one individual who had pulled $50,000 from his savings, their life retirement savings account, to survive the recession and help pay the bills for their child's care. And even so, because of that, that money they took out of their savings counted as income, even though their household income was $30,000 a year. They're not making it, and the solution is many times they're telling them, just drop off medical assistance, which in effect say, don't get your kid the care they need if you can't afford it. And I think that's not the way Minnesota wants to go. This is not a huge part of it. This is, I think it was about a 10% bump that we'd be asking to not extend that 10% increase longer. And I have here Ms. Salini from White Bear, and Steve Larson from ARC, Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Ms. Salini? Welcome to the committee. State your name again for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Leslie Salini, and I currently reside in Ramsey County. My husband and I have 3 beautiful children, Cassandra, 27, Christopher, 23, and Sean, who's 12. Sean was born with Down syndrome. We didn't know that he had Down syndrome until he was 5 days old. The doctor noticed a little bend in his pinky finger. After many blood tests were run, we went home, and the last words we heard from the doctor was, "Don't worry, I really don't think he has Down syndrome." The next day, we did receive the call from the doctor, and he quietly said, "The test came back positive. Your child has Down syndrome." At that point, it threw us into a tailspin. It's at that point that we realized our life plan had changed forever. The fear of the unknown hit us hard. We didn't know anything about this disability, but we moved forward and now can't imagine life without him. We are very blessed to have Sean in our lives. After 11 years, we finally decided Sean needed some additional resources that my family couldn't provide him. This is the reason our family finally made the decision to contact the county and look into options to help Sean become more comfortable with others and to learn to trust others. We always thought we could do it on our own, but now realize that we can't. And having Sean feel this way is not healthy for him or for us. After filling out what felt like hundreds of papers, Sean finally was granted medical assistance 5 months later. When I received my first invoice from the county, it took my breath away. The bill was nearly $8,000. This is double what our private insurance deductibles are. And as it was stated previously, we are required to keep our private insurance in addition to the medical assistance, so we have both those premiums to pay. It doesn't make any sense. After seeing the high fees charged for mandated services that my vulnerable child requires to live safely in our community, it made my heart sink for our family. We went from total elation that we finally took this step in Sean's life to total deflation. Thoughts of what have I done started going through my head. Here I thought it was doing something great for our entire family, not just for Sean. When in reality, it has caused more stress on my family. It's just one vicious circle. Having to pay high fees just because Sean was born with a disability is devastating. The response from the county to my concerns over the high parental fee
was if there is not any ability to reduce the fees, we can certainly have a conversation about the pros and cons of staying on medical assistance. In my eyes, the answer is not to quit, but to find a solution that works for everyone. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened, so we may be forced to drop MA due to the stress of a high fee, leaving us back to square one. All the hard work we have done up to this point is great, but any outlook for additional care in the future is looking bleak. Why should Sean pay the price for this? He is the one who will suffer the most if we are forced to drop MA. People are struggling to make it day by day. We shouldn't have to choose between getting much-needed services for our child and buying groceries or fixing our vehicle to get back and forth to work. My husband and I have worked very hard in life to get where we are today, and we feel we are in some way being punished for that success. We don't make a lot of money, but we were getting by. I now understand, again, why many families are forced to go down to one-income families in order for their son or daughter to receive the care they need. However, parental providers are paying the price, too. Some find the only way to survive life caring for a child with special needs is to be the primary caretaker for that child. They quit their professional jobs to become a caretaker, making just over $13 an hour. However, half of that goes back to the state to cover their parental fee. Sean wants to work and to go to college. He has many, many dreams. He doesn't want to sit around and see life pass by. This is why this program was designed, to help those who need it. Obviously, there are more expenses to raising a child with special needs. So these services should be beneficial to families and help them acquire the tools needed to ensure their child's success. If we give them the tools to succeed, they will become much more independent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Delaney. Mr. Larson?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Steve Larson, the Senior Policy Director for the ARC Minnesota. The ARC advocates for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I'll just add a few more details. Senator Marty gave a nice background for the bill. This is a year of health care for Minnesotans. We're trying to get as many low-income Minnesotans and other Minnesotans connected with health care. And yet we have this population, this group of 8,000 families that pays parental fees. And so Leslie did an excellent job of representing those 8,000 families and the challenges they have. The number we don't have are the number of families that aren't part of that 8,000 that could be on medical assistance but cannot afford the parental fees, and therefore their children are not getting the therapies, the PCA services, and other vital services that are only available through programs funded by medical assistance. And so we're here to advocate for those families. This is a modest proposal. We're merely rolling back to what the fees were in 2010. This cost to the state, according to the fiscal note, is only $565,000. But we did want to bring this to the attention of the legislature and see if we could be successful with this modest proposal so that legislators and the rest of the community understands the sacrifices that these families make to keep their children at home. Minnesota has been very successful in keeping children with disabilities in their parental homes, but this is a major challenge for doing that, and so we seek your support on House or Senate File 980 today.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. And Senator Marty, I see that this was a temporary budget solution when it was passed, and that it is due to expire in the 16-17 biennium anyway. So really what this is ending this increase in the parental fees earlier than it was already scheduled to end. So, I mean, I think even when this was passed, it was recognized that this would be a significant hardship on many families. And I think that what we have before us demonstrates that this cost would only be borne in the upcoming biennium and really try to help people. I know when I've talked with people about it, you find that this is actually a disincentive to work. Families are driven to quitting one job, having a single income supporting them, or even looking at divorce, strategic divorce to eliminate income. And it's a difficult situation we're putting families in with disabled children. And it is a reasonable ask. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I noticed on the fiscal note that, and perhaps you could speak to this, Senator Marty, or one of the testifiers, or maybe you know as well, Senator Lurie. It says some counties assess parental fees for out-of-home placements under the statute and would experience a decrease in revenue. Can you speak to that? I'm only thinking about that, not just in relationship to this bill, but there's a variety of bills that I've introduced that do ask counties to pick up costs, and I know that that's a problem for them. So I just would like to have an understanding of the implications of that.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. I caught that as well and neglected to ask that question. And I don't know if anyone from counties are here, but Senator Marty, Mr. Larson.
Chair and Senator Sharon, on the second page, there's a series of bullets, and you go down to the sixth or seventh bullet, and it says counties will continue to be reimbursed 6.9% of fees collected. And so I think that's what that following statement is referring to. But we do have staff from DHS that work on parental fees that could answer that more specifically if Senator Sharon would desire that.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. And if they're not
Senator
here, if we could get that, if they're here. Okay.
Totally.
And I would like to understand what that means, that 6.9% of fees collected, is that less? In the end, is this creating less and therefore demanding more of counties from their own resources?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon. My name is Joe. The last name is Jarris. It's spelled J-A-R. O-S is in Sam, Z is in Zebra. Excuse me. And I supervise the parental fee unit at the Department of Human Services. The question that you're asking, referring to the counties using the fee schedule, counties will assess fees in some situations, specifically certain out-of-home placements, for example, juvenile detention. Counties, when they assess the fee there, some counties use the fee schedule in this particular statute, or they may use other fee schedules. So for the counties that are using the fee schedule into 252.27, they would see a reduction in their receipts as well, because obviously the fee assessment would be going down.
But let me suggest then that it seems to me it's at their option to use the state's fee schedule or not. So, I mean, if they were unhappy with this change that was actually recently enacted, they wouldn't need to seek legislative authority to discontinue the use of our fee schedule. They could decide to use the fee schedule that was in place, for the last couple of years if they wish. Would that be a correct assessment? So really, we're not talking about any additional burden unless the counties, an individual county decided to take on that burden.
Sure, that's correct.
Is that
the
correct
counties
assessment?
Can
Good.
Use whatever fee schedule that they want to, or modify it, or make their own.
Good. Yeah. That helps. Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A quick question maybe for our testifier here on for the Solanis. There's a number here. It was nearly $8,000. If it reverts back to, and this bill is included, what would be the amount? Instead of the $8,000, what would be the amount you would be paying then?
I believe the total amount, and Steve, you might have to clarify this. I believe it would be $100 a year right now is what it ends up being for me.
So it would go from being $8,000 in every month to
$8,000
a year.
Yep.
Okay, to $100 a year.
No. To $7,900 a year.
This is
10%.
I would see it would go down $100.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, it's a small percentage we're asking for. It was the additional one that was added three, four years ago. We'd be asking it to go back to that level.
I understand. I'm just trying to get a handle on it.
Small
portion. Yes, very small. Thank you.
Any other questions of members? Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question would be, I think, for Mr. Larson. I was just curious. I know it's my understanding about 10 years ago there were some significant fee increases that occurred. And if there's any evidence as to what happened with families that were receiving the MA TEFRA, you mentioned that 8,000 families are currently on the program, and if the numbers dropped from where it was 10 years ago, or that might be, and maybe the bigger problem is people not coming onto the program because of the sticker shock and seeing the cost. I don't know how much, how many would have dropped out, but I was wondering if you have any numbers on that. And of course, it's hard to ascertain, I guess, how many are not joining or not taking the program because of the cost. But is there any evidence as far as how much is how many have dropped out of the program?
Mr. Chair and Senator Eakin, in a fiscal note developed 5 or 6 years ago, when the when it was proposed at that time to increase parental fees, the fiscal note said that 500 families would drop off because of the increase. And Mr. Jarsa can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but that's the type of thing that we're looking at. Every time we raise the fees, there's fewer families that can afford it. But you're absolutely right, too, that it's hard to understand or have the specific information of how many families aren't on because of the fees.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions of members? Seeing none. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I understand the difficult budget, and I think we have to work at changing that because I think these services are that important. I do suggest that if you do consider this for possible inclusion, this is a drafting thing, but rather than just changing the date, we might just delete those last paragraphs, the alternative fee schedule, save a few pages of statute perhaps, and just make that effective that day.
Thank you. I'll instruct staff to consider that instead of this change, because you're right. We could get rid of all that from 4.8 forward and would do that if it were to be
included. If it's possible, yes.
No other questions from members? Anyone else in the audience care to testify either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 980? Seeing none.
I'll move it.
Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 980. Did you have an amendment on this? No. That Senate File 980 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Hayden. Hope you got a drink of water before starting.
Yeah,
Senator Hayden,
I know.
You have quite the...
Oh, we have quite the marathon session here. I'll talk fast.
I think we're going to start with Senate File 1383. Does that work for you?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Okay. That's ninth on the agenda for members in the audience. This is Aliveness Project.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 1383, the Aliveness Project. It's a statewide nonprofit providing health and wellness services. There's a handout for members, but I wanted to highlight a few of its accomplishments of this program. In 2012, the Aliveness Project served 1,747 unduplicated clients, 9% more than the previous year, and provided 36,000 volunteer hours provided by 1,700 volunteers, the equivalent of 17 FTEs. 90% of its members surveyed indicated that the service of the Aliveness Project assists them to live independently, avoiding more costly out-of-home placement. 74% of members surveyed indicated that these services make it possible for me to work, and 78% of the members surveyed indicated that these services helped me keep working at my current job. That is from the actual participants. So today we have two testifiers. We have we have multiple testifiers, and I'll let them introduce themselves because I don't know if I know everybody who's here, and talk a little bit more about the bill and what we're trying to do.
Okay, and if testimony could be, you know, succinct and to the point and get to the fiscal implications of this, it would be greatly appreciated. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Hancox. I live in Golden Valley, Minnesota, and I'm here as a volunteer with the Aliveness Project today. I'm also employed as the executive director of the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. but I'm here in a capacity today as a volunteer to. And I want to compliment Senator Hayden. His review of the stats from our 2012 service year pretty much encapsulates my testimony that I intended to provide. So I won't – no, that's perfectly all right. I won't bore the committee with repetition. If you please, I would like to just move directly to our two witnesses.
Absolutely.
We have two individuals visiting with us today who are actually recipients of services at the Aliveness Project. I'd like to introduce them. And then also myself and the executive director, Joe Larson, would be happy to stand for any questions that the committee may have following that testimony, sir.
Well, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your
Thank
testimony.
You. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name
could
is
you,
Hazel.
Could you slide forward? You
sure.
Got to kind of eat that microphone almost.
My name is Hazel Erickson. And I'm 72 years old, and I'm also HIV positive and have been for 17 years. I'm not your typical person to have it, but here I am, and I'm living very well. I moved to Minnesota in 2001 to care for my mother, who was having a triple bypass. She now is 92, so she just had a birthday, thank you very much, and she's doing very well. But I was first told that the northern part of Minnesota didn't really have services for people with HIV, and I had just come from Albuquerque, where we had state-of-the-art, so I got up there, and I was afraid that I was not going to be able to get services. So I was very, very much alone and very frightened. Well, I happened to find a gentleman that lived in my mother's village, and he also had AIDS. And he connected me to the Aliveness Project because he was familiar with it. So we get food from our food shelf. And we get hot meals, and it's really kind of fun to go down to have a nice hot meal that's with other people that are also HIV positive or have AIDS. And we enjoy each other's conversations and the community feeling that we have. We also have alternative therapies like acupuncture, massage therapy, that type of thing. At Christmas time, we get a wonderful basket, which is very important to me because I'm older, I'm single, and both of my children have passed, so I'm kind of out there on my own. When I have problems or anything, I manage to go to the Aliveness Project because I know I can get the answers that I need and help along with the friendships that I have there. Other than that, it's just a wonderful place to be. I know that I'm not alone feeling that way. I would very much enjoy having any of you come to the Aliveness Project and check out some of our services, see what we have. Come and have a meal with us. In fact, I'll even buy.
Ms. Erickson, you said northern Minnesota? Is that?
That's where I lived, was up in Hubbard County is where I was.
Okay.
But they seemed to not think that there was anyone up there. And I did find out because I had been an advocate in Albuquerque, I found out that there were 7 people in that county because I knew the demographic count. And so I'm very active in our community. So.
Thank you.
Thank you
for your testimony.
Thank you.
And you have one more client.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is in committee. My name is Johnny Anderson, and I am a Vietnam era veteran. I am 60 years old and I live in Hennepin County. And I was referred to the Aliveness Project by the nurse at the VA hospital. And living on a limited disability income, it is very nice to have meals served at the Aliveness Project 6 days a week, where you can get a very nutritious meal and know that you're going to live a healthy life by eating there. And like Hazel said, they do have all the other things. They have massages and acupuncture and Reiki and just all the different services for the members that help us continue to live healthier lives. And that's pretty much what I have to say. It's, and so that's it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, if I may, David Hancock's again. The reason that we're here today, I'm sure you have the legislation in front of you, is to ask for a one-time appropriation of $300,000. As you can tell, perhaps by the testimony, Hazel and Johnny represent just a small percentage of the number of individuals that are served through the Aliveness Project every year in its various programs. And the tremendous success of the Aliveness Project since it was begun in 1985 has caused it to outgrow its space, its headquarters in South Minneapolis, where a lot of these services are provided on a daily basis. And the $300,000 that we're asking as a one-time appropriation would greatly assist the Aliveness Project to move into a larger space that will allow them to continue to grow and deliver their services in an effective and meaningful way in Minneapolis.
Okay, thank you. That was actually going to be my question, is how, you know, a program that obviously needs to sustain and be operational for the individual served, how does a one-time appropriation meet those goals? So it's dedicated to helping move into a new space.
Correct. New space, that allow you to, that's correct, Mr. Chair. New space has been identified and has been purchased. We're in the process now of moving from our existing space to the new, larger space that will, again, allow us to expand and continue those services. So this one-time appropriation is a request for assistance in helping to achieve that goal.
Thank you, Mr. Hancock. Other questions of members?
Okay. That's
seeing none, anyone else in the audience care to testify either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 1383? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 1383 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator.
Thank you.
File 706 next, Senator Hayden, if you're ready.
Let's go. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 706. This bill is a Hennepin Health pilot.
Looks like you have an A1 author's amendment. Is this
I think so.
First hearing?
Yep.
What's second?
No, it's not the first hearing, so you'll have to present the bill and then offer the amendment, so okay. It wouldn't be an author's.
So, Mr. Chair, this bill, it would remove the statutory cap on enrollment and allow Hennepin County to negotiate with DHS to enroll other targeted MA populations. These populations could benefit from Hennepin healthcare delivery model that integrates medical care with social service to support health, wellness, and community-based care. Other populations could be persons with disabilities and families who are currently receiving income and employment service in any other county program. Jennifer DeCubellis, Area Director of Hennepin County Human Services and the Public Health Department, is here to answer any questions and to talk a little bit more about what they are trying to do with this bill.
Ms. DeCubellis, did you wish to offer testimony or just stand for questions?
I'm okay just standing for questions if the committee prefers, since I recently spoke to this committee.
You spoke to the policy committee, I believe. We presented this in the policy committee.
Then if I could make a couple brief
comments. Yeah, make a couple of brief comments, because there isn't entire overlap.
Okay.
So, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, Jennifer DeCubellis with Hennepin County. What I wanted to just remind you is we did come before the committee earlier about Hennepin Health. Hennepin Health, real quickly, is a demonstration project in partnership with the Department of Human Services.
Oh, yes.
We are collaborating across the county system. So we have the county hospital, HCMC, social services at the county, the Human Services and Public Health Department, Metropolitan Health Plan, which is the county-operated HMO, as well as North Point Health and Wellness, the federally qualified health care center, as well as over 85 additional community providers. working to reduce costs and improve health outcomes for some of our neediest residents. The pilot right now is working with the Medicaid expansion population, which is single adults with without dependent children in the home, those at or below 75% of federal poverty level. So our lowest income recipients, and what we're finding is they are often our highest cost. So they are often deep end in social services as well as healthcare services. Because lives are in crisis at that low income level, there's high utilization of emergency room services, inpatient admissions, and often healthcare gets into a crisis before systems are aware of the needs. And what the project has done in the first year is we've launched over 30 different initiatives, all of which had over a 30% cost reduction as well as health improvements attached to them. We have reduced spending. We have improved health outcomes. Clients are enjoying the program, and satisfaction is high. As a result of that, what we're looking at is, for this population, what we learned is all of the different ways the system is failing the members. So we often put people into programs. This project has allowed us to see where is the program not working and how do we bring the health plan, social services, the providers together and the hospital together in order to improve outcomes. What we are dependent on is the population. So a couple examples I'd give quickly. Dental care, for example, high utilization of our emergency department for dental care. As soon as we identified that in this population, we were able to put solutions that were lower cost, better health outcomes for our members. High behavioral health needs with this population, we were able to identify, a list of things that were broken in behavioral health and how do we work across social services and healthcare in order to make impacts. What we're limited by in the project is we're limited to fixing the healthcare system for this one population, and what we're looking for is some flexibility. So this amendment to the pilot allows us to look at other high-cost, high-utilizers, and how do we repair the system in order to get better health outcomes for lower cost, and that's what we're here asking for today.
Okay. And it is my understanding that there is not a fiscal cost with making this change, let members know, I think that it still needs to stay within our division because the House didn't meet deadlines to get it to the floor, so we'll have to keep this back to keep it in the omnibus. Bill, it appears with the A1 amendment that we probably in working with DHS have a little different crafting of how to talk about the ability for Hennepin County to get additional recipients in to be served. Is that correct?
It's a clarification of the language.
Okay. And so Senator Hayden moves the A1 amendment. Any questions on that amendment?
I think the amendment needs to be amended.
Yes. Page 1, line 5, the reference to page 12 should say page 1, delete lines 13 and 14. Correct? Is that what you're looking at, Senator Sharon? So with that oral amendment to the amendment incorporated, Senator Hayden moves the A1 amendment. Any further questions on the amendment? The amendment was in the packet for members. So any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves the A1 amendment, incorporating the oral amendment to it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, motion prevails. Okay, we have Senate File 706 before us then, and Senator Hayden moves Senate File 706 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to offer testimony either in support or in opposition to Senate File 706? Seeing none, on Senator Hayden's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hayden and Ms. Deacobilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
All right. Let's see. I think we can... another Hennepin County,
yep.
Senate File 147.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Senate File 147, I do have some talking points, but I'm going to let Ms. DeCubelis just kind of go over the bill in the interest of time.
Okay, Ms. DeCubelis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, Jennifer DeCubelis with Hennepin County. What we're looking to do, again, no fiscal note on this, is really same project, the Hennepin Health Project, is to look at removing the copays. As we've gone through the Hennepin Health Project, what we have done is we're constantly looking for where is there value-added services, where is there administrative simplification. And this really is an administrative simplification we'd like to test. With the poverty level of these folks, over 80% have no cost sharing. However, our health plan and our providers need to touch every single person. So for the less than 20% where there is a cost sharing of that population, less than 25% actually pay that cost sharing. However, we have to touch every file. We have to load these cost sharing measures into the records. The providers, when somebody goes to fill a script, every single pharmacist has to look it up. There's very little gain and a lot of administrative cost when we look across the time that staff spend trying to comply with this copayment measure. So what we're willing to do is absorb that and get out of the burden of having to continue to do that with this low-income population and to pilot it and see, does it make a difference? Part of the project for Hennepin Health is getting people out of crisis venues and into primary care. One way we can do that is also taking away some of that concern for that small population who do have a copay and making sure that they're engaging proactively in preventative services.
Thank you, Ms. DeCabellis. Any questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the logic behind this, but I am concerned about the long-term effects, and I hope you do watch how this is affected, because the copays, there is a philosophy out there that does make people more accountable to have a skin in the game. And you can talk to any dentist who serves the MA population, or anybody who serves this population believes that there should be some accountability measure from the patient on their part of keeping the appointment, doing all the preventive measures, and just being using this project well. So I know this is a pilot project, but this is really big change for me to say, you know, you have no responsibility, no skin in the game, basically. And so,
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I've heard that philosophy a lot, and I don't necessarily think that I disagree with it in the most broadest sense. But I do know in working with this population, and I think that Ms. DeCabellis will tell you that the providers that serve this specific population, that it becomes an impairment to them getting the services that they need that are preventive and early interventive services that save us a lot of money if there is kind of this co-pay aspect of it. So folks are – it's kind of in the inverse, and it's counterintuitive. I know, Senator Rosen, we've talked a lot about this. But it actually keeps them from getting the services that they need. That then costs us much more money later on. And then I think Ms. DeCabellis could obviously articulate and has the ideal of folks aren't paying it, but they're still getting the services, and then they administratively have to go and try to collect dollars that they're unable to get. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing that I'll say about this that I think is really unique is that the county, it is a pilot project, and they are willing to eat the cost and watch that. And I think that if that becomes cost prohibitive for them, then I think that they'll be able to have to make those administrative changes. So I appreciate that. And I think that logic does fly in the most broadest sense. But I think when you start digging deep and start to deal with the population that Hennepin Health is working with, then I think that it kind of flips.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. DeCabellis.
Mr. Chair, Senators, if I can address that, I have several just case examples of where that philosophy for this population really doesn't work. And if we remember that the income levels of this group are less than $600 a month, it's hard to even pay rent for that. So when we place, I have an individual who had hypertension and was constantly in the emergency department, in and out of corrections, in and out of our ED, in our shelters. And what we found when we talked to that individual was, why aren't you taking the medication that helps you stay out of the hospital? And his very response was, if I have to give $2 for this medication every single month, or I can get a meal that day, I'm taking the meal. And again, it's crisis, lives in crisis, and the priorities for this lowest income population. I agree. The skin in the game we want them to have is an investment to get into preventive care and out of our emergency departments, and that's where we're trying to get them and encourage the responsibility.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I can't even say because I'm just not good at that. I completely get this, and I definitely understand the direction and the help we want to give for this population. But what I'd also like to know in this pilot project, and hopefully there is some tracking about how many missed appointments there are from this population that we're serving, and that's a pilot project. Their responsibility going forward with no co-pays, no accountability. I think, and any other measures that we can throw in there to make sure that this isn't taken for granted. And I'm not throwing accusations around, but this, sometimes when you do receive those free services, and it has proven to be true, especially in the dental population, and there's very few dentists out there that will provide MA coverage because the change, they don't show up for appointments, there's no continuation of the preventive care that we are trying to accomplish. And if we can guarantee that with this program, that they will take the responsibility by not sharing in the copay, in the cost, then I'm all for it.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. DeGabalas.
Senator, thank you. Yes, and we do have measures in place. So we are watching for engagement at preventive care. We're watching for disengagement out of crisis services, watching for that cost shifting. And what I really like about the Hennepin Health Project being able to pilot this is we see across systems. So we can see if we're cost shifting elsewhere. We can monitor those administrative costs, and we will keep a tight lid on the impact of if it's a positive or not.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
I just want to comment on the last interaction. I know Senator Rosen does not believe this, but I know for this population that the complexity of issues that they're dealing with in order to even make an appointment for a job interview or make an appointment to check on a possible rental opportunity or to keep a medical appointment, the complexity of being able to accomplish that and the cause of a failure to accomplish an appointment cannot be you cannot assume it's a lack of responsibility. It there are so many other complexities in these people's lives that make follow through difficult, and then they get slapped upside the head because of the circumstances they're in. But my question really is, the value of the co-payments shall not be included in the capitation amount to the managed care organization. Could somebody simply tell me what that means and why that's in there? Senator Franzen, did you want to do that?
Senator
Senator Hayden. You're laughing at me. No, you're laughing.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think
Ms. DeCabellis.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you. What it is we're just showing that this is a flat fiscal note, that right. It's we're not going to come and say now that there's no co-payment, we need the state to add to our payment. It keeps it cost neutral and allows us to just absorb that and actually reduce our administrative costs because we're not now putting in a bunch of numbers that mean nothing.
Great. All right. Any other questions on Senate File 147? Seeing none, anyone else in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 147? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 147 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Now, this is dyslexia inducing. We have 7:41 now.
Good eye.
But we're going to try to keep it straight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 741.
And the handout you just handed out said Senate File 471,
yes.
Demonstrating my point clearly.
Oh, yeah.
There's a message.
Is it 741?
It's all good.
Which one is
it? It's Senate File 741, but the handout says Senate File 471, but it's just a typo. It's okay. We're going to be able to roll. It's all good.
Well, Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Whatever bill that I'm doing, I have Fartoon Welly here today. She's the founder and executive director of a nonprofit that works to erase health care disparities in the Somali community. Just a couple of things, and then I would like her to say a little bit about herself and what we're trying to do with the bill. The bill aims to address specific problems in the Somali community. As a growing constituency group, Somali cultures and attitudes towards health must be addressed. Ms. Welly will talk to you, and what is, if I may say, what's unique and what caught my eye is in working with Ms. Welly, she talked a lot about issues, especially around women's reproductive issues in the Somali community, and some of the complex, it's complex in nature, as we know, in general, but as well as in the Somali community, there are a lot of layers relative to their culture, and she has done a phenomenal job in kind of peeling back some of those issues and having that direct conversation with Somali women that most of us in this room would not be able to have at that level of candor. So with that being said, I'll turn over the microphone to Ms. Welly to talk about it. I will say that we are looking for $170,000 appropriation, which we think is going to continue to allow Insaroon, which is the group that Ms. Welly has founded, to do that great work. So.
Ms. Welly, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record one more time and present your testimony.
Fortune Welly, thank you. I'm kind of new to this chair and the committee. I'm here today. I know we're pressed for time, but I want to make sure that I tell you why I'm here. I'm not here to ask funding to fund a program. As a community of immigrants, we're concerned about the health inequality that exists. And I myself is a public health professional. I'll be graduating this May. And my goal is, we talk about health disparity, minority health disparity, and what I try to do is, what does that mean, and what is the definition of minority? Are we talking about Hispanics? Are we talking about Somalis? Are we talking about Ethiopians? Are we talking about Oromos? Are we talking about anybody who the language is, English is not their first language? So what's happening is that the healthcare system, the way that health inequality is addressed is one size fits all. And the first mistake that we've made as a state, as a Department of Health, as a DHS or on health plans is not asking the question is who really are the audiences, who are the minorities, and putting everybody in the same boat and delivering the same health education and the same services is not helping communities such as ours. So I'm asking to get this $170,000 to find a strategy that answers the question is, who are the minority, who are Somali community, what are our needs, who are allies, how we can get out of the poverty that if you look at the sheet that we gave you, our community is suffering. And this is not new. The immigrants that came before us, the first generation were poor, but there was a strategy of getting out of that poverty so the next generation could have a better life and better opportunities. And that is not happening for our community. As a woman, as a Muslim, as an immigrant woman, my role as a community to choose me was to find a way to get out of the poverty. And then what's happening is that we try to network with the the Department of Health. We've tried to network with the Office of Multicultural Services, and what we found out is that there's nothing happening. Everything's like you have to fit the group norm thinking. You have to fit the one-size-fit-all kind of mentality, and that is not working. All of the bills that Senator Jeff Hayden and other senators did is an outcome of the real strategy that not being asked to develop specifically catered services and exit strategy of the poverty. So every year you give eliminating health disparities $7.5 million to address health inequality. as a public health professional, I know for a fact that this money is insufficient and does not address anything that a black community or immigrant community suffers, because there is no planning. And we talk about tonight, you have a budget issue and you want to know what is the return of this investment. You got nothing. Every year, 2010, 11, 12, the legislative report that you get is the same, identical. The population of black community immigrants, the health disparity and the poverty is at the bottom. Everyone else is at the top. No idea or no solutions of no strategy of exit strategy. No one is offering it. I'm concerned the human capacity of our community and other communities who are poor and wanted to have an exit strategy. This bill, what we're doing is use a strategy that CDC supports it, is a method that the community uses it to organize themselves, identify resources, but also identify what is cultural specific to this specific community, and then come to forward into the mainstream and identify partnership. I believe unless this happens, we can throw millions of dollars, who, by the way, are insufficient and is not doing anything, and we'll have more prisons, more healthcare costs, more health and human services issues. But as you are considered human cost and a cost of finance, we as a community of immigrants, as a woman, we're concerned to have a next generation of Somali immigrants to have a better life. And this will support a journey. And I hope you support that journey with us.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Welly. Senator Hayden, did you have additional comments?
No. Okay. I think, Mr. Chair, she's done a great job at articulating the
any other questions of the committee? Seeing none, you had no amendments either. Anyone else in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or in opposition to Senate File 741? I'm seeing none. Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 741 be laid recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senate File 1071, and this is probably going to be the last bill we attempt to take up this morning. Thank you, members, for bearing with us as we work through this. Senate File 1071, Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1071. Members, in 2007, the state passed legislation looking for a solution to one of the most intractable problems we faced, the costly and repeated use of multiple expensive public services by a relatively small number of high-risk adults cycling through our state's correction system. These high-risk adults tend to be young, black, African-American men. 2007, we created a demonstration project intended to develop and test a model that would show the state how to improve outcomes for this population and reduce cost. Such a demonstration would have to run for a period of time long enough to allow a statistically significant number of participants to be tracked to ensure the outcomes are measurable in real compared to the status quo. This bill seeks to fund the completion of this five-year endeavor. Through a competitive bid process, the Network for Better Futures was selected to undertake a major demonstration project and embark on creating this model in 2008. But the state didn't fully fund the project. Rather, the network used state funding to leverage additional funding and has created a business unit that generates earned income by employing participants on work crews. Funding sources to date has been the state, $3.7 million, private philanthropy, $9 million, the county, Hennepin County, $1.5 million, earned business income $2 million through Better Futures Incorporated, an affiliated nonprofit established solely to create jobs for the participant, primarily using the work crew model. Since 2008, the network has collaborated with state and counties to implement a new model with a very promising preliminary results. Much better outcomes for participants, job creation for very, very difficult to employ group, and demonstrable public savings. The pilot is built on a pay-for-performance contracting on long-term financial sustainability. This is fundamental to the demonstration because over the long term, this new model must do more than promise and do better. It must deliver meaningful results to earn revenue from the state and counties. This pilot demonstrates a high-risk adult is a big idea. It reimagines a different way to address a longstanding social and economic problem, and it demonstrates ways to reform costly policies and practices and perpetuate dependency on with the poorest results. Over the past 5 years, the network has intentionally engaged some of the hardest to serve people in our communities. It has tested, refined, integrated care service model that's generating very promising results. This bill seeks the final funding to complete the demonstration of $1.4 million. Today I have Mr. Daryl Lindsay, Chief Operating Officer of the network, who will briefly describe the funding, what this funding will provide. We also have Jermaine Markham, who will speak to the bill as well.
Mr. Lindsay, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Daryl Lindsay. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Network for Better Futures. Thank you to Senator Hayden for the comments that he just made. He pretty much prescribed those comments that I'll make, but I'll be brief in reviewing those. I'd also, at the end of my comments, like to introduce Jermaine Davis, who is here with us this morning. He's a participant with the network and will be giving testimony on how things have worked for him during his tenure with the network. All right. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak to Senate File 1071. As you've already heard, the network was selected through a competitive bid to The network was selected by the state through a competitive bid process to develop and fully evaluate an integrated care model aimed at reducing the economic and social cost of high-risk adults. Again, one-time funding of $1.4 million is needed to complete this pilot, which is already showing some favorable results. After completion, a fully funded independent evaluation can be completed. A return on investment analysis can be calculated, and a full accounting of the costs and current policies and practices can be completed. The pilot is demonstrating effective ways to reform the costly systems and practices that perpetuate the chaos and cycles of dependency experienced by the high-risk men we serve. By setting high expectations and providing direct access to the resources needed to meet these expectations, that being housing, behavioral health, primary health care, employment, and life coaching, participants are offered an opportunity to become contributing, productive, and healthy members of society. So, why DHS? What we know is that this population has needs, and that those needs cross several different state agencies, that being corrections, housing, jobs, Department of Public Safety, and Health and Human Services. To date, we have been able to receive funding from the corrections budget, from the housing budget, deed budget, and DPS through some OJP funding. We see this initiative as a public health initiative, and it's addressing serious health, behavioral health, and social issues that affect public systems at the local, county, and state levels. For example, our pilot engages a group of underserved people, mostly impoverished men, with disproportionate rates of chronic disease. For example, among 40 men examined in our health home at HCMC over a six-month period, we noted that 70% of those men had serious or serious and persistent mental illness. 35% were dependent on drugs and alcohol, and 18% needed treatment for diabetes. In addition, a majority of staff time, our life coaching and counseling, is getting men ready to work and housing support. This is focused on dealing with chronic health and behavioral health issues and providing trauma-informed care for the men we serve. Furthermore, 60% of the men we serve are fathers, and since most of these men are working, they are paying their child support and reengaging in a positive manner with their families. The pilot's integrated care approach also complements and helps to build a coordinated care network envisioned under the Affordable Care Act. We introduce and connect all participants to a health home, and we help enroll participants in a health plan and work to keep them enrolled as they move and their incomes change. We are also committed to fully developing a pay-for-performance reimbursement model as a way to sustain this new model of success financially. We already have a modest pay-for-performance contract with Hennepin County, and we would hope to establish a similar outcome-based reimbursement approach with the Department of Human Services if, in fact, the funding is approved. Under a pay-for-performance structure, the network is accountable for achieving increased employment, improved health outcomes, increased child support payments, and reduced use of jail and prisons. The value of appropriating the $1.4 million to complete this demonstration is substantial. What's needed to complete this demonstration is $5 million. The $1.4 million that the state would appropriate would then leverage another $3.6 million in other funds not to mention $1.2 million in earned business income. It would also allow us to enroll another 200 high-risk men, of which 220 men will be engaged with us at any one time. 120 men will be employed part-time, and 12 full-time jobs will be created. An independent evaluation will be fully funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Effective ways to maintain connections between high-risk adults and primary health care networks will be developed more fully. And the data from the independent evaluation will help inform ways to reduce and control state spending and improve the performance of state programs. The state's investment will help to further develop and fully implement a viable pay-for-performance reimbursement model that might be used as we move forward in this endeavor. Again, I just appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning and give testimony on this pay-for-success model that the network is endeavoring to build. And at this time, with the chair's permission, I'd like to have Mr. Davis provide testimony on how the network has worked for him.
Mr. Davis, welcome to the committee.
I come from a long background. I spent the vast majority of my life incarcerated. So when I got out, I have no job skills, no way to just visualize how to live rather than the way I was living. And when I got enrolled in the network, you know, they have support groups, trauma sessions that help you just go back in time and, you know, start from the beginning when the problems start so we can find a solution. You know, it's good to have the life coaches be on your neck and make sure that everything you say you want to achieve in life, you do it. And nothing is given to us. We have to earn everything that we receive. The bank account, you know, it's required for us to have bank accounts. You know, leasing our name, we had to get full-time jobs. So I had to go volunteer places so I could get job skills and build up references and stuff like that and learn how to completely fill out a resume. All these things was new to me. It was a challenge for me to come from where I come from. I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. And up there, it was a battlefield. So I come up here with my mother to try and find a new way. But my mother, she's on drugs. So, you know, it'd be a lot of, you know, just backlash from her never being a mother. So for me to try to go out and do things, I never really was cooperative with what she say because I was looking to her eyes of a dope fiend. So I got kicked out of her house. I was homeless. I ain't had nowhere to go. So I first thing came to my mind to go back to know what I do best, and that was crime. But I was introduced to the network, and it been a great, just wonderful. You know, I'm a taxpayer now. I got a bank account, live in my own house. I got a baby on the way, and I heard you say something about success earlier. You know, for me to be coming from where I'm come from to be where I'm at now to sit and talk in front of y'all, it's really like, you know, it blows me away. It's a different kind of high. And I have a baby on the way, and I'm sitting over here listening to these people talk about these kids growing up in shelters and stuff. That's why I take time out of my day to come out here to support the network because they support me in a vast majority of my life. By me having a child now and having my own apartment and I got consolidation plans going on, I don't see in the future no kid of mine being homeless. So this is very critical, and I want to see this thing rolling because in the future I see myself on the board. You know, they might get old and run out of ideas. All right. So I want to be able to step up because it's real. Helped my life, so it'll be a big blessing for me. That's to great. Turn around from a street life to a real life to do what they do. And I want to thank y'all for your time again.
Mr. Davis, thank you for giving up your time, and it's a real high for us to see people putting their best foot forward and succeeding as well. It's what we're all looking to achieve, and seeing the results when this happens is really meaningful to us as well. So thank you for your testimony. Any questions of members? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Davis. I think what I want to first say to you is that congratulations. This is, I'm sure that you're intimidated sitting there because I know that it's no different for any of us who sit around this side of the table to sit there because we're often intimidated too. And I think the fact that you have recognized what it takes to turn your life around is absolutely admirable. And I think your child is going to have a great dad. So I thank you for what you've done, and I think that this you're an absolutely tremendous spokesman for this program.
Hint.
Mr. Davis. Oh, no. Did you have a response?
No, sir.
That's fine. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Any other questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, I want to support this publicly. I have supported this bill in the past. I think this is a perfect example of a program where there is accountability measures, there's outcomes that can be measured, there is kind of that pay-for-performance attitude, whatever. I want to thank Mr. Davis for coming and testify. You did a great job. And it really means a lot to have your story in front of us. So I know this is a lot of money, but I think it's money well served. I know it's going to end, and I'll be asking questions about how are they going to continue the program going forward. But congratulations on keeping it this long. It's done a good job.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1071? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 1071 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hayden.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Now, that's as far as we're going to be able to make it this morning, so we will recess till 6 p.m. tonight. Thank you, members.